Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands.
All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio in a downtown, rainy downtown Chicago. Rainy, wet morning here. I'm looking out the window here, 18 stories above downtown Chicago, and it's wet out there, so be careful. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Also, it's Triple Play Thursday.
Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday.
Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. We'll play them later. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. So, we're live here. And coming up in just a few minutes, our good friend Dan Feinberg is going to join us. It's time for his biweekly visit. He's the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Lots of TV to talk about with Dan, and we will get to that in just a few minutes. Speaking of TV, we're going to jump into some of the most outrageous late-night TV moments ever. We'll go back into some late-night TV and talk about some of those moments and some of your favorite late-night TV moments from years ago, some recently, whatever. We'll talk late-night TV coming up and some of the more outrageous moments ever. And in honor of the royal baby that was just born and just named, his name is Archie. And it's officially not Archibald. I was surprised by that. It's actually Archie. I thought for sure it would be Archibald.
I know.
But it's Archie.
I thought, I hope his brother's name is Jughead or something.
Yeah, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it? So we're going to talk about some of the best portrayals of monarchs in movies and TV shows. We got more coming up, too. And we always want to hear from you at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. Whatever's happening on the show is happening on the Facebook page. You should like us right now and hang out on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. And also subscribe to our podcast because every single moment of every single show is available on podcast. And you can subscribe. Go to iTunes, wherever you get your podcast, subscribe. It's free, and it will be automatically sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. And we thank everybody. We have a lot of people who listen to us via podcast, and we thank you for that. Okay, again, 312-981-7200 for talking text and Triple Play Thursday requests.
Yeah!
There you go. Let me say hello officially to my great producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
I'm doing great, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. I wish the Cubs would win in more dramatic fashion every once in a while.
Wouldn't that be nice?
It's unbelievable, man. Unbelievable. In the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, sir.
How are you, man?
Doing well.
I two nights in a row, walk-off home runs to win the game. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was a walk-off. I was watching the game, and then I had to leave my apartment to walk to work.
Yeah.
And so I saw they, you know, we were tied when I left my apartment. I saw we won on the way. I Googled it before I even got here.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize it was another walk-off.
Yeah, walk-off. If I'm not mistaken, it was a two-strike count again. And this time it was Hayward off a lefty in the opposite. He went to the opposite off a lefty. I just, you know, I'm so happy for Hayward. I am. I'm happy that he's playing good baseball and that, you know, because, you know, he took a lot of heat for having a couple of bad seasons with the Cubs, especially the World Series season.
Yeah.
And they're paying him a lot of money, and people were very disappointed. And he had a bad season, especially in 2016. But I always root for the guy. One of the main reasons is because of the rain delay in Game 7. He's the guy who pulled everybody together. He's the guy who gave him the speech. He cares about the team. He really does. And that was a game changer. They won the World Series. One of the reasons why they won that World Series was because Hayward called that meeting during the rain delay. And I will always remember him for that. And I will always respect him and love him for that. And I love that he's doing well. So
makes you wonder what he said.
I would love to have been a fly on the wall for that thing. Because that, listen, during that rain delay, I was pacing. I was, like, losing my mind because the game was insane anyway. And then, like, they come back from commercial, and I seriously was like, you got to be kidding me. A rain delay? We're going to add a rain delay to this game? If this game hasn't been insane enough already? And I've said this before, best Game 7 in the history of World Series. And I'm not just saying that because the Cubs won it. I mean, it was an incredible series all the way through. You know, Cubs-Indians was an incredible series. But that Game 7 was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. So anyway, I'm glad Hayward's doing well, and it was nice to see him get the walk-off last night. So, yeah. Cubs, man. I don't know.
We could all use a prescription to Lipitor.
You know, it's this, they do this to me every year, man. I don't even know what, you know. Because I get it, you know, involved in. You think I'm emotional about it, man. You should see my dad. Like I've said before, my dad, lifelong Cub fan. Maniac Cub fan, and I'm not. This is not an exaggeration. Let's just set this up. If it was September, late September, and the Cubs were 20 games under 500, he would still watch every game, sit on the edge of the couch, and scream at the TV. That's.
I don't know many other teams that would inspire that sort of fervor.
Yeah. Oh, he's the biggest Cub fan I know. So anyway, well, that was fun. That was fun. That was a fun night. So. All right. Well, listen, we got a lot of TV to talk about. You know, Dan Feinberg joins us. You can follow him at the Fine Print, F-I-E-N, on Twitter and on Facebook. And Dan joins us every 2 weeks. Read his stuff at The Hollywood Reporter. And right after we take a break here, Dan Feinberg will be here, and he will join us and talk about lots of TV. And it's always a lot of fun to talk with Dan. Again, get your Triple Play requests in right now. Triple Play Thursday, and it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. TV party tonight! We're gonna have a TV party tonight! All right! We're gonna have a TV party, all right! Tonight! Saturday Night Live! All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here, 18 floors above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday. It means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. It's one artist, three songs. One artist, three songs. Get them in now. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. A little later on, we're going to be talking about the most memorable and most outrageous moments in late-night TV. And we're going to talk about the best and most memorable fictional monarchs in honor of Archie. and that's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, Triple Play Thursday requests. And there you go. All right, it's time to talk with our friend Dan Feinberg. Dan Feinberg joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Always a lot of TV to talk about. And so let's welcome Dan back to the show. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. How you been?
Oh, just watching lots of TV. How about you?
I've been doing that as well, and other stuff, but I've been catching up on some TV and watching the regular stuff that I really enjoy. Let's start now because last we talked, there was this episode of Barry that that aired, and I so want to talk with you about the episode Ronnie Lilly, which I watched three times in one sitting. I've seen it five times now, and I can't even express how much I love that episode of television. It's unbelievable, and I'm sure you liked it.
That is some Teddy Perkins level of watching of that episode.
That's exactly what I thought of. Exactly what I thought of. I was like, that's the Teddy Perkins of this season.
Phew. Okay, I have not watched it that many times. I have only had the time to watch it twice, which felt like enough because I did want to watch it a second time. There was some, I guess maybe Tuesday or Monday of last week where I just had watched too much TV and there was nothing I wanted to watch. And so I plunked on that episode of Barry and noticed new things every second I was watching it, which is the same with Teddy Perkins. So absolutely.
I really thought that Hader made a statement as a director with this one because he directed the hell out of it. And for people who have not seen it, have not seen that episode, and it was 2 weeks ago, over 2 weeks ago. It's kind of a standoff episode. It's kind of a standalone episode. It still carries the plot along. But it just is, you know, Henry Winkler's not in it. Sarah Goldberg's not in it. NoHo Hank is not in it. It's just this insane episode where Bill Hader is sent, a police officer is blackmailing him into killing his ex-wife's new boyfriend, and it's just Hader and the new boyfriend, who turns out to be a Taekwondo master, and their confrontation, and then the confrontation with that Taekwondo master's incredible nut daughter. The only other regular character in it is Fuchs. It's beyond insane. I couldn't believe it when I was watching it. I thought the incredible long takes, the way that Hader choreographed the whole thing. And by the time the girl shows up, it just goes into another, dimension.
How I describe it to people is that it's a Coen Brothers movie in 31 minutes. That's how I would describe it. It is that kind of wacky violence, anything can happen, no particular rules of logic or gravity or fight choreography, just crazed, bizarre, magnificently timed humor and action. And it was the same night as the Game of Thrones episode that everybody was anticipating and everybody was talking about. And that episode was 82 minutes of being bludgeoned in the dark, and it was sometimes very effective and impressive and whatever. But watching just how consummately and meticulously crafted and how clean and neat this episode of Barry was, and how hilarious in a season that has really not been all that funny, this episode was a return to Barry being out and out, laugh out loud, hilarious, and it was funnier even the second time because there were so many things that I wasn't noticing the first time because my attention was on one corner of the frame and something else was happening elsewhere, or I wasn't paying attention to which things actually were all being done in one shot and which weren't. It was really an impressive episode.
It was incredible. It was really incredible. And I don't watch Game of Thrones, as we talked about before, Dan, but even the Game of Thrones fans, including my producer, Tom, who is a big Game of Thrones fan, everybody who I know who watches Game of Thrones said that Barry kind of pulled the rug out from under from under that much hyped episode. Everybody was like, well, I didn't think Barry was going to be better than the episode of Game of Thrones that everybody had been talking about for 2 weeks.
I think there were some people who felt that way. I mean, I think if you go and you look at the actual numbers, probably 20 times the number of people watched that Game of Thrones episode as watched the Barry episode.
Sure.
On the other hand, Game of Thrones has been benefiting Barry in the ratings significantly, which is a nice thing to see. So honestly, what I keep saying over and over again is how clean the episode of Barry was because of how murky and dark and crazed in a different way the Game of Thrones episode was, and just how much I appreciated the change of tone. And then this week's episode felt like more of a return to, I would say, late season one Barry, and that there were things that were funny and many more than in the first, say, three or four episodes of the season.
That one episode, the Ronnie Lilly episode, is obviously, you know, there's not going to be another episode like it during this season of Barry, because they got back to normal. As normal as Barry can be, as normal as that show can be, it went back to normal. And I knew that they would do that, because you can't do more episodes like that without just completely having people think the show's gone completely off the deep end. But there are just so many things about that episode that just kill me. I love the blood goatee. I can't even explain how much I love the blood goatee. And and the reveal that that Ronnie is still alive in the grocery store, and the look on the clerk's face when he sees Barry going looking for looking for bandages, all of that stuff. It's just, and it's so beautiful. Like, as you said, it's so meticulously timed, and it was laugh out loud funny. But I got to say, this girl, Jessie Giacomazzi, who is the daughter of stunt performers, the little girl was unbelievable. She was absolutely incredible, and I got a feeling we're gonna be seeing more of her.
I would hope that Barry would find a way to get her back at some point, having seen the reaction. No, I have one or two colleagues/friends who felt as if the episode and kind of the return to zany comedy kind of devalued some of the attempted seriousness that the show had built to in the first few episodes of the season. I don't know that I feel that way, but I do have colleagues who I respect who felt that way, and that's fine. I just viewed it as the show saying this is a world and a sensibility that still exists and that we can still play around with, and just because we've shown that we can go more serious does not mean that that's what the entire world is. And you know, just because we've made it look like there's this one outsized corner of the world in NoHo Hank and his various stretchings and whatever,
right,
doesn't mean that there aren't other corners of absurdity still to be explored. Right. I appreciated that.
I just loved it. And Stephen Root is, you know, well, he's a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. And he is so hilarious in that episode. Just so funny. He's funny all the time, but he's particularly funny. And his line reading on "What are you?" is just one of my favorite moments of the TV season. That episode just kind of came out of nowhere. I wasn't aware that there was going to be an episode like this. There was no hype about it. I just thought it was going to be another really good episode of Barry, and what 5 minutes in, I'm like, what do we got here? So it was a wonderful surprise.
I knew it was coming because several of my colleagues had sort of hinted on Twitter that that week's Barry was a little crazy and that it was a bit of a change of pace. So I knew something was coming, but even knowing that was coming, I would not have expected the episode as it unfolded.
Now, the expected Emmy nominations for this show come out. If they want Hader to get a director nomination, that's the episode to submit. Correct?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I assume they will. I assume they know. But then again, I feel like you get to submit multiple directing episodes.
Oh, okay.
I would assume that is one that they will definitely be submitting. And definitely got more discussion than most of the season so far, and they would be fools not to recognize what a good episode it was for Hader as a director. I think the previous episode was actually probably better for Hader as an actor, but
yeah,
that's a preference.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right. We're going to get to, I promise, we're going to get to new TV, but I hadn't talked to Dan since it aired, and it's like my favorite television episode like ever. One of my favorite television episodes ever, so we had to talk about it. All right, we're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll dive into more TV. Dan Feinberg is with us, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every 2 weeks. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. More after the news. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5 a.m. as we are every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. It is Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in right now. We'll play them later. That's one artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about the most memorable and outrageous late-night moments, late-night TV moments. And in honor of Archie, we will be talking about some of the best and most memorable fictional monarchs of all time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number right now. We're talking TV. Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter joins us every 2 weeks. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We bring Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
You know, we were looking at some of your tweets, and I mentioned Archie. And I just wanted to, I'm sure you probably don't know this. I've probably never spoken to you about this, but The Chocolate War is like my favorite book of all time. And I got it from my, we were talking about Teacher Appreciation Week the other morning, and I mentioned when my eighth grade teacher, her name was Miss Nagel, and I was a voracious reader when I was younger, and I was leading our class in book reports. I had the most book reports of anybody. So at the end of the year, right before I graduated, elementary school, she gave me a copy of The Chocolate War and said, I think you should read this book. And it was a game changer for me. It taught me not to trust authority, not to question anything that any adults say. It taught me, and I know this sounds like a negative, but it taught me to be cynical. And it was a book that literally sort of changed the way I thought of things. And it's right up there with Catcher in the Rye as a life-changing book. And the fact that you referenced in your tweet, you referenced Archie Costello is unbelievable to me. So to explain The Chocolate War reference, Dan.
I would have to give the entire plot of The Chocolate War, right, but Archie Costello is the assailant in The Vigils, the group that runs this prep school in The Chocolate War. And it is legitimately, when I hear Archie, first I really and truly do think of Archie Andrews, but I think of Archie Andrews from the glory days of the Archie comics and not from Riverdale.
Right.
So that is still who I think of legitimately in first. And then I saw a lot of people in my Twitter feed posting pictures of Cary Grant because of his real name.
Right.
And I'm just like, someone needs to mention Archie Costello from The Chocolate War.
I love that, Dan.
Darn it, I did. The high school that I went to in northern Massachusetts was the high school that Robert Cormier went to. And so,
oh, is that right?
Indeed. And so Leominster High School, Leominster, Massachusetts, represent. So he's kind of worshipped as a god there, and for logical reasons. He's a great, one of the great YA novelists ever, and he wrote other very, very good books, but yep. The Chocolate War is the pinnacle.
Yeah, I obviously dug into everything he wrote after I read The Chocolate War, but now when I got to ask you, what did you think of the Keith Gordon movie?
I don't think it's very good, because they couldn't do it. You just couldn't. What I told someone on Twitter today was that someone with guts should attempt to do it as a 6-part or 8-part miniseries now on a streaming service. I think Amazon or something, you can actually do the brutality of the Robert Cormier ending, and where you can actually have the cynicism that book has, and just the bleak worldview, because you just couldn't do that in the movie at the time it came out. It's got a great cast.
And I think there are moments in it. I think John Glover is great in it as Brother Leon. I think he's great. It's got a really good cast, and I think there are moments in it that I really like. But I was so angry by the end of the movie, I wanted to punch Keith Gordon in the face. I don't mean that ironically. I'm just saying, like, I was so angry about the change that they made. Completely upending what that book was about, you know?
You could not do it. And I'm not 100% convinced you could do it today in an actual studio-supported movie. I think maybe if you could somehow do it independently, that would be one thing. But no, I'm not sure you could do it today.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if an Amazon were to get behind it, someone on Twitter again, plus Twitter, suggested Bob Odenkirk as Brother Leon, and I am 100% on board with that.
That would be great, yeah.
So to me, it feels as if basically the movie happened but didn't exactly happen, and certainly didn't tell the story in the way that it needed to be told.
Right.
So I would love for someone to attempt to bring that back and see what they could do, because I think it's essentially a timeless story. It's that good and that resilient a narrative.
I couldn't agree with you more. I just found it unbelievably cool that you mentioned Archie Costello. I just want to see. Yeah, for is there another reason why I can like Dan Feinberg more? There it is.
So some of my tweets are probably for like a dozen people, but I'm always happy when they hit home.
Well, that's, trust me, I just went whoa when I saw that tweet. So very cool. All right, I just dug into Dead to Me. I started watching it yesterday, and I'm about 4 episodes in. And I really, really like it. And I know that you had a review of it. This is a tough one to talk about, though, Dan, as you know.
Ooh, it is. Look, it's a much easier one to talk about it now than it was before it premiered, because the list of do not spoils that Netflix sent to critics was as frustrating as I have ever experienced outside of something like Mad Men, where Matt Wiener's letters were always sort of legendary for the things that we couldn't reveal, including what year it was and whether people were still knew each other. We couldn't do that. But this, it was this whole list of things that, to my mind, weren't spoilers, or to my mind were spoilers only of the first episode and a half of a 10-episode series, etc. So, yeah, it's a tough one to talk about.
It is.
But for those who don't know, the show stars Christina Applegate as a woman whose husband died in a hit-and-run that has never been solved. At her grief counseling group, she meets another woman who says that she's mourning her lost fiancé. That woman is played by Linda Cardellini. They become friends, but there are lots and lots of secrets, and things become involved.
Right, and I think that's as far as we can go with it. I really do. I'm only four episodes in. I'm not even halfway through the season, and there have been more surprises and twists in it, although some of them you can see a mile away. A lot of the twists aren't all that surprising, but they're really well done. And I can't, even going into this, I was going to be biased because I adore both of these women. They're two of my favorite actresses, and I love them so much, and they're both great in the show.
In my review, I described the mystery aspect of the plot, or the thriller aspect of the plot, as kind of gravy, and I described it as gravy that you put on an ice cream sundae.
Right.
because, look, the two actresses are wonderful, and they are so good. And the way that the show discusses female friendship, and the way that the show discusses grief, and how you move forward in your life when everything is reminding you of the person and the thing you lost, and all of that, it does those things so well. And yet the twists and the cliffhangers are kind of what propels the story along, and I don't really know that they're necessary, and yet it's what gets people to watch and to keep watching. So it's hard to know how to handle it, because I think that it's by far the weakest aspect of the story, the twists and the cliffhangers. But I guess you need it there, and so if that gets people to watch a show that has these two wonderful lead performances and that has things to say of value, then I guess it's the price to pay, and it does, you know, it pushes you along episode to episode without any question.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I agree with you 100% about that statement. I really do, and I can't say enough about Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini. They're both so great singularly in the show, and especially together. It's so much fun to watch those two in doing scenes together. And I also want to mention, and I don't know the kid's name, and I feel like a jerk, her older son in the show, I think is fantastic. I think he's really, really good and brings a lot to it. And Ed Asner's in it, for God's sake. Come on, you know?
Well, I mean, Ed Asner was also in the first season of Cobra Kai, for heaven's sake. So sometimes Ed Asner just likes to work. And Ed Asner is so well deployed here, and it's such a reminder that very few people hit punchlines like Ed Asner does.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
By all means. No, it's James Marsden is great in it, though certainly seeing anything at all specific about his character was part of what we were instructed not to spoil,
right.
I'm not going to. Basically, I think my review just acknowledged he was in the show.
Right.
which, to my mind, really dramatically shortchanges him. I think that, as a result, people weren't able to say how very good he is in their reviews because Netflix wanted to step in and make it all twisty and stuff. Whatever.
Yeah. Well, I just think I was just very excited for these two women who I've always loved. I mean, I've loved Linda Cardellini since Freaks and Geeks. I even like her in the Daddy's Home movies, for God's sake. And Christina Applegate has been a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned, since Married with Children. And to see them have, like, really juicy roles like this is really gratifying and a lot of fun. So I'm really enjoying the show, and I'm going to finish it probably in a day or two. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. That show that we were just talking about is called Dead to Me. It's on Netflix, and it's I highly recommend it. I'm four episodes in, and I think it's pretty great. And we didn't talk about a lot of it because there's a lot of twists and turns in it. So, okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got more TV talk with Dan after this. Good morning. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. We are talking TV right now with Dan Feinberg, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every other week. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Always a lot of TV to talk about. Let's get Dan back in here. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
I have not seen the show yet. Again, this is another Netflix show. I have seen one sketch, and it's called I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson. I've only seen one sketch because I have a friend who sent a link to me because he knows how much I love Vanessa Bayer. And so it was the Vanessa Bayer sketch with the Instagram, which I thought was absolutely hilarious. And I became a big Tim Robinson fan because of Detroiters, which was a show that I thought was unbelievably funny and it was one of those deals where you discover, like Michaela Watkins and like Jenny Slate, how underused, incredibly talented people have been in the past on SNL. And Tim Robinson made me realize that when I saw Detroiters. And so I really think the guy is great. What do you think of I Think You Should Leave?
The thing I like most about it, if I'm being perfectly honest, is that the episodes are only 15 minutes long.
Right.
So if you haven't actually dug into it, you could be done with it in less than 2 hours.
Okay.
It goes by very fast. And look, if I'm being honest, I've seen four of the six episodes. I think it is somewhat repetitive, and maybe that doesn't necessarily go so well with a show that's designed to be binge watched. And so, you start noticing that there are certain words that he just finds really, really funny, most of which I can't say on the radio.
Right.
He definitely gets a kick out of them, and certain kind of images that he likes doing, and certain build-ups and crescendos that he likes doing. But it is definitely funny, and it goes by so fast that even if a sketch is repetitive and not all that clever, it's on to the next one before you notice it, on to the next episode. I think that it's we did not review it because it just sort of snuck onto Netflix to some degree. They did give us screeners, but just was never pushed aggressively. But it's one of the things that Netflix has been doing more recently. They had the comedy special, which was all episodes between 11 and 17 minutes. They had the S&M comedy Bonds, which I haven't watched yet, but I hear is somewhat comparable in terms of really short episodes, and it's a thing that Netflix should be doing, where they say, okay, sometimes things really only need to be 15 minutes per episode or whatever. It obviously has to cap costs. It has to encourage people to just keep watching, because you're almost surprised when it gets to be 15 minutes of the first episode. You're like, hey, it's over. Okay, might as well watch the second episode. I allotted 30 minutes of my time. So I think it's good. I think you will really, really like it. If you've been, you will start to notice that certain things, he goes back to certain wells fairly frequently, and maybe the second season, who knows. But so many of his various SNL friends, apparently he made a lot of friends while he was on SNL, but probably he knew them before from the improv world.
Sure.
But lots of familiar people, in addition to Vanessa Bayer, pop up frequently. It's, he's got funny friends, and he's fairly funny, and there are good sketches and bad sketches, but even the bad sketches go by fast.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it. I didn't know about, like you said, I didn't know about it at all until that person sent me the clip that sent me the sketch with Vanessa Bayer, and I was like, what is this show? I didn't even know about it. So I didn't know that they were 15 minutes. I can knock that thing out today.
Oh, yeah, no, it goes by very, very fast. Okay. Again, I've watched four. I think it's only six episodes total. Gone.
Great. I'm looking forward to it. All right. Now, we'll stick with Netflix again. And this is a BoJack Horseman spinoff, Tuca and Birdie.
It is not a BoJack Horseman spinoff, but it definitely looks and feels a fair amount like BoJack Horseman. It is created by Lisa Hanawalt, who was the lead cartoonist, production designer, eventually executive producer on BoJack Horseman. And she created Tuca and Birdie and wrote the pilot script with Raphael Bob Waksberg, who created BoJack Horseman. And most of the directors and several of the writers, et cetera, also come from BoJack. But it feels simultaneously very similar because it looks a lot like BoJack because it's the same animator, but the feeling is very different. The premise of this one is that, the premise of BoJack is a manic depressive horse who's right. constantly isolating himself and making him alone,
right.
whereas the premise of Tuca and Birdie is these two lifelong friends who are also birds. One is a toucan, one is a songbird, voiced by Tiffany Haddish and Ali Wong. And they're just friends in a fictional city, again, a contrast to the Hollywoo of BoJack Horseman.
Right.
And it's full of big colors, fun, life, large fits of whimsy, the kind of thing that BoJack just can't do because its hero is so internalized and so frequently miserable and so part of the Hollywood machine, and so everything revolves around that for BoJack. This, it's wide open. The animation does all sorts of crazy things just because it can. So, okay, fine. A brief claymation sequence? Why the heck not? A brief puppetry sequence in which you can see the person's hand in the scene? Sure, why not? You know, a scene that looks like retro computer animation? Sure, why not? You know, it does a lot of things. It's not as intellectual as BoJack. It's much more about feelings and emotions. It's also, like Dead to Me, it is a show about female friendship. So if you feel like you miss Broad City, it's a lot like Broad City. And if you watch these characters, you'll see how these two characters are really a lot like Abby and Alana. And their friendship is a lot like Abby and Alana's friendship. And the sort of the backdrop of women needing each other as friends, because having friends is a good thing, while also trying to move on with their lives in other ways, it's a significant and meaningful backdrop, and I think there's a lot to really, really enjoy about this show. It takes it maybe 30 minutes, you know, the first episode, to kind of get over the, wait, why is this not BoJack? Why are the jokes not BoJack jokes, et cetera, et cetera. But the show itself is a real pleasure to watch.
Okay, great. That's great. So people are going to bring baggage to it because they're going to think it's BoJack, and it's not.
And also because the BoJack audience, BoJack will presumably skew more male, more sort of sardonic, sarcastic, grumpy, you know, which I resemble very frequently. And so you watch this, and it's touchy-feely, it's joyful, it's playful in an entirely different way, and yet, you know, they go into a bookstore, and you can still look at the cover of every single book and keep pausing, and see the 55 jokes, the 75 puns. It still has that kind of humor. It's just not the only thing the show is. It's also not the only thing the show is on BoJack either.
Right.
BoJack is a great show, obviously. I love me some BoJack. I just think this is a very good show that requires people accept that it's not BoJack, even though it looks and sometimes feels like BoJack.
Okay. There you go. That's Tuca and Birdie, which is it streaming now, right?
Yes, it is now available on Netflix.
There you go, Tuca and Birdie. That's another one I got to put on my list. Hey, apropos of nothing, Dan, before we break here, did you watch last night's Daily Show with Trevor?
I have not yet.
Okay.
But I will.
Okay. I don't know if I've laughed harder at anything that Trevor Noah has done this year, but he unearths a bunch of footage from a 1980s local Vermont cable TV show that Bernie Sanders hosted. And it is, I don't know if I've laughed harder at anything that the Daily Show has done this season than this. And it's simply, it's funny, mostly because of the footage. The footage is unbelievable, but also because of Trevor's reaction to it. It's the top story after the headlines in the first segment of the show. And it's hilarious. I didn't know whether you had watched it or not, but I was crying with laughter while watching it.
I will be watching that probably with caffeine in the morning, and apropos of the same nothing, have you watched last night's What We Do in the Shadows?
No, it's on my DVR. As soon as I get home, I watch it, and yeah, that's immediately
guaranteed to blow your mind.
Is it right? Because I'm enjoying. I know that you run hot and cold on the TV series. I'm really enjoying it. I'm glad it got renewed. And the projectile vomiting sequence from last week. I don't know if I've la- where the Baron is just flying and smashing into buildings while projectile vomiting after eating the pizza. I just thought it was hilarious.
I've liked the last few. I hated the werewolf episode. I thought it was just awful, and it really made me concerned. And I'm like, oh no, I'm turning on the show entirely. I thought the last couple were really good, and last night's episode is tremendous.
Okay, great. I can't wait. It's the first thing I'm going to do when I get home. Okay, Dan, hang on. Okay.
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. We have to break here, and we'll come back. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and at Facebook on The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N. And we got the news coming up, and then afterwards we'll jump right back into TV Talk with Dan. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're back. And how are you doing? It's a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Get them in now. We'll play them later. That's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're going to be talking about some of the more outrageous and memorable moments in late-night TV. And we're going to talk about great fictional monarchs and much more. And if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. Let's get back to our talk about TV. Every 2 weeks, Dan Feinberg joins me, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's get back to the conversation. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. So you had a kind of a roundtable discussion, you guys, about the best spring shows. Let's touch upon that. It was you and Tim Goodman.
The basic thesis was the only things that anybody is talking about on TV are basically Game of Thrones and maybe Veep and Barry on the side. Are there still television shows that people need to be watching, or was all the oxygen sucked out of the room by these HBO juggernauts? And we came to the shocking conclusion that yes, there are other good shows on TV. Stunning, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, what did you guys? What were some of your choices that are not HBO related?
Ah, see. And since I feel like we've only talked about Netflix on this conversation so far, I'm going to talk a little bit about Hulu now,
okay.
Because you know it's important to have other streaming services. Also, Hulu's just had a great spring, and we kind of made fun of Hulu when they moved Handmaid's Tale out of the way of Game of Thrones because they knew it was going to get crushed at the Emmys, and they were probably correct to do that. But Hulu's spring has included The Act, which I still need to finish, but is a really good, twisted, weird, true crime thing that will surely get Emmy nominations for Patricia Arquette and Joey King.
Yes.
And then they have these three comedies that have all now been renewed, I believe, and that all have these distinctive voices, and even if they aren't fully put together necessarily immediately, in some cases they are. So there's Shrill. Have you watched Shrill yet?
I have not.
I
know. It's a big hurdle for me to get over, considering how I feel about Eddie Bryant. But
I understand it's only six episodes, yeah, but it's also, of the three, the least good to my mind. So, like, I want to tell you that you need to watch because you want to apologize to Eddie Bryant, but
okay,
but it's not the one I would tell you to watch first. I don't remember. Have we talked about Pen 15? Have you watched?
No, no. We haven't talked about it.
Okay, you really should watch Pen 15, or as I'm prone to calling it, Hulu's Penis, because that's the joke. It's just this. Quirky, strange comedy where the premise is that the two creators or co-creators, Anna Kunkel and Maya Erskine, who are actresses in their upper 20s, lower 30s, are playing 13-year-old kind of versions of themselves. And the rest of the cast is all real middle school actors. And that is the premise, and it sounds like a gimmick, and occasionally it is a gimmick, but it's also just this really exposing look at being a middle school student and at growing through puberty and kind of the... It sort of tears apart the this is the most awkward moment of your life and it gets better, because it puts these two people who have gone through the it gets better and it's putting them back in this world. So it's really great. But the best of the three Hulu comedies, and I mentioned this to you on Facebook when you were waxing rhapsodic about Barry, is Rami.
Yeah, which and, I still haven't gotten to it yet. And you mentioned you mentioned episode 4, correct?
Episode 4 is the big episode, and I'm saying no more about it than that. You obviously have to go through the first three to get there. But it's a remarkable first season of a show. It really is, because it is a show just about a 20-something Muslim man living in New Jersey who wants to be young and have fun, but also wants to follow his religion. And it's not in any way the narrative that you expect from a show like this, where the narrative is he's got these disapproving parents and he doesn't want any part of the religion and he wants to be a modern American and blah blah blah, and it's this huge imposition that he has to be religious. No, he wants to observe his faith. He wants to fast on Ramadan. He wants to pray 5 times a day, etc. He also wants to hook up with women and other things. But it's just a really, it's the kind of show that people, when they say, why does no one ever talk about religion on TV? Why does TV ignore religion? Well, those people also are going to be completely ignoring this show, which is as earnest, but also frequently incredibly funny, a show about religion as TV has had in years. It is so assured and so confident in its storytelling. And it, while the fourth episode is the standout episode, and will be a contender for best of the year lists, the show just gets better as it goes along and just does all of these risk-taking things with storytelling and with character, and I just admire it so much. So yeah. So while there have been other good things this year on other networks, Hulu's had a great spring, and that was one of the things that I made sure that we concentrated on in the back-and-forth piece that started this long celebration of Hulu's spring.
There you go. All right. And it's available at The Hollywood Reporter, and it's the debate of the best spring shows, shining a light on some of the shows that maybe you haven't seen before or weren't aware of. So there you go. All right. So what do you think now? You know, we'll jump into something else, but how are you feeling about Game of Thrones so far?
I thought this week's episode was borderline brutal, and kind
not
of
not just because of the coffee cup.
If it is so strange to me that we are in the home stretch of one of the biggest shows in recent television history. This was the anti-penultimate episode. It is the over the halfway point in this season, and the thing that people have been talking about for the past 3 or 4 days is the stupid coffee cup.
Right.
But part of why people have been talking about the stupid coffee cup is because if you talk about the episode itself, you get stuck talking about all the stupid things the characters did in the episode and all of the frustrating things that the writers did to the characters that kind of tore so many of them asunder. So, yeah, there was that coffee cup, and you know, I don't understand how that happens. I've seen people, I think Trevor Noah made a joke, ha ha ha, about a PA who made a mistake and he was going to get their head cut off. Yeah. And like, ha ha ha, whatever. But, you know, anyone who knows anything about how TV works knows that it wasn't a PA who made the mistake. It was like 200 people.
Yeah, of course.
Who made the mistake. Yeah. And it starts with a script supervisor or a director or the cinematographer, all of whom presumably were looking at the scene and didn't pay attention. Every actor who was in the scene didn't pay attention. Yeah. But there had to have been a dozen people who have been working nonstop to be editing this episode, and somehow none of them noticed there was this stupid coffee cup in the frame. I don't know how it happens, but I guess it beats talking about how the show sold out half of its female characters this week. So, yay.
Yeah, that was a big my producer Tom watches it and he felt the same way about the portrayal of the female characters in it. And it wasn't happy about it. So,
it was a mess, and it was disheartening because there are two episodes left.
Yeah.
There are two episodes left, and you can't have, with two episodes left, fans as unhappy as they were after this last episode. And I went from, I've sort of, my excitement has dwindled as we get closer and closer to the end, because I become more and more convinced as we get towards the end that wherever it's going to end is not going to make me happy. And so...
Yeah.
That's right. Where I am.
Okay, well let's end the conversations with our biweekly mention of Better Things. a show that is consistently fantastic, and maybe the best on TV, and last week's episode again was pretty extraordinary, made me cry. It's just a great, great show. We have to mention Pamela Adlon every time we visit. Would you agree, Dan?
I am happy to do so, and also entirely happy to end on a positive note, because it was yet another great episode and sort of began to get us into some depth on how the show has kind of become this vaguely supernatural show this season. Because Sam's father, Pamela Adlon's character's father, has been popping up for a scene a week, basically as his ghost, and it hasn't been explained. But the show has made great use of Olivia Edward this season.
Yeah.
She plays Duke, Sam's youngest daughter, and they've just gotten so much value out of her, which you can never count on doing with a young actor.
Yeah.
And this week, the scene with the sandwich.
Oh my god!
it was a little bit disturbing. It was a whole lot sad.
Yeah,
and it was just you just sat there and went, oh
yeah, oh. Exactly. It's just such a great show. I look forward to it every week. So, all right, Dan, always a pleasure, my friend. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. And a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him at The Fine Print. That's FIEN. And you're working on, what are you going to be posting up next? Any other reviews coming up?
Well, the thing is, next week is Upfronts week. So next week is going to be a nonstop fiesta of new programs, trailer reviews, sort of how networks are rearranging their schedules. So that is the thing that is kind of on tap for next week.
Okay.
That's going to make next week utter chaos.
All right. Well, we'll cover the whole thing the next time you're on, okay?
It will be perfectly timed in 2 weeks. Looking forward to
it. Perfect. All right. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
You too.
Okay. Dan Feinberg, everybody. Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. And we'll talk to him again in a couple of weeks. Take a break right now here on 720 WEGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 a.m. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the most outrageous late-night TV moments of all time. What were some of your favorite late-night TV moments? 312-981-7200. Talk or text. Also, it's Triple Play Thursday. You mean Triple Play Thursday? One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Now, here's the question. Are we going to hear a triple play of John Fogerty, or are we also going to hear some CCR?
We are going to hear some CCR.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought it was going to be just straight solo Fogerty, of which he's got a bunch of songs.
Sure.
Who requested the CCR / Fogerty?
That was Dave and Monroe.
Dave and Monroe. Nice choice, my friend. Nice choice. All right, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in. One artist, three songs.
Yeah!
312-981-7200 is the phone number. I just want to mention my next film club screening here. We had a great, great screening just this past Tuesday night. A fantastic turnout, and we watched Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest on the big screen. And it was so much fun. I was just putting together my event invites for our next film club screening. And my next film club screening is going to be a really fun one, and I know it's going to be a real popular one, too. We'll be celebrating the 35th anniversary of Ghostbusters by showing it on the big screen. It is, I can't believe it's 35 years old, but it's going to be on Tuesday, June 11th, and it's at 8 o'clock at the AMC Rosemont 18, formerly Movico, over there on Bryn Mawr Avenue, right off the expressway, easy to get to. If you don't want to drive, take the blue line, get off at Rosemont, it's a five-minute walk. So we're going to be showing Ghostbusters on the big screen, obviously Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Harold Ramis, Ernie Hudson, Sigourney Weaver, Rick Moranis, and a true classic comedy from the 80s. And so to celebrate the 35th anniversary, we're going to show that on the big screen. And right down the street from the theater is Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant. And we've been partnering with these guys since December when we screened Scrooged with Bill Murray. But we've been, you know, even if Bill Murray's not in a movie, we still have a partnership with these guys. But Bill Murray's obviously in Ghostbusters, one of the most popular movies that he's ever been in. So they're going to have a whole bunch of specials. And one of the deals is that every month, actually, when you come to my film club, if you go to the Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant, which is located in the Crown Plaza Hotel right down the street from the theater, they offer the film club members a 15% discount on all their food. You just have to have like your ticket stub or your phone proving that you're going to go see the movie. Say you're with the film club, we're going to see Ghostbusters, and they will give you 15% off of all your food purchases. Plus, there are going to be drink specials, and we're going to celebrate Ghostbusters and have like a Ghostbusters party beforehand. So it's going to be a really, really fun night. And I know so many people out there love Ghostbusters. It's got a very, very, very passionate fan base, and I know that it's going to be well represented. I might have some of the local Ghostbusters cosplay people show up in costume. We might have that happen. There might be an Ecto-mobile in front of the theater. You know, Tom, I've screened Back to the Future twice over the years that I've done my film club as part of last year's Zemeckis Fest, where we did the whole summer and into the fall. We did all Robert Zemeckis movies, which it was fantastic for me because he's one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. And then we also continued it. Patty and I hosted a screening of Welcome to Marwen, which was also great. And so, but anyway, when we did Back to the Future the first time, it was years before last year, someone brought their DeLorean and parked it out in front of the theater, like a car collector who's got a DeLorean.
Yeah, I was going to say, who's got a DeLorean?
He's a car collector, this guy, and he brought his DeLorean and parked it out front, so that was fun. So maybe we'll get the Ecto-mobile out there, the Ghostbusters Ecto-mobile out in front, and we'll have some Ghostbusters cosplay people in costume.
Do you know if it does the siren? Does it do that?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it does. So people are going to be very excited about this. So we're going to have a big party, 35th anniversary celebration of Ghostbusters. Again, it's Tuesday, June 11th, and if you've never seen it on the time, I know you've never seen it on the big screen, right?
No.
Yeah, this is an opportunity to see it on the big screen.
Only on VHS.
Yeah. Well, this is a big difference than VHS. This is a
really better quality, you think?
Better quality. It's the it's the 4K restored version of it digitally, and it's going to look fantastic.
Beautiful.
And this the theater that we use on the second floor of the AMC Rosemont is the biggest theater that they have there with the biggest screen. So we always want the best looking, you know, movies. So so get there early. Go down the street to the Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant as part of the Ghostbusters celebration. There's going to be drink specials at 15% off all of your food, and then skip on over to the theater at the AMC Rosemont 18. It starts at 8 o'clock. I will introduce it. We'll watch Ghostbusters 35th anniversary party. Watch Ghostbusters, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. And lots of stories about the making of Ghostbusters, lots of stories about the history of Ghostbusters. And I know that, you know, there are a lot of hardcore fans of Ghostbusters who will show up and probably know more than I do. And because we opened up for a Q&A at the end of the night, because I'll give a whole bunch of stories and trivia and stuff like that. I'll talk for a while, and then I open it up for a Q&A. And inevitably, there are at least like two or three people, depending on the movie, who are in there who are like, hey, I know this much about the movie, and then they spill the beans on what they know about it. And I know that there are a lot of hardcore Ghostbusters fans out there who know a lot more about the movie than I do. So I expect them to be out there, too. Again, $10 for the movie. Parking is free. You can reserve your seats now at amctheaters.com. They're on sale right now, and they're actually going pretty well already, and it's over a month away. It's June 11th, Tuesday, June 11th. So reserve your seats now. They'll be waiting for you on Tuesday, June 11th. Go to amctheaters.com, hit the seating chart, pick the seats, amctheaters.com. Also, if you want to call the Caddyshack restaurant, they will take a reservation for you. If you just have questions about the film club, mention the film club, the screening of Ghostbusters. You can call 847-443-3673. That's 847-443-3673. Tell them you're with the Nick DiGiulio Film Club. You're going to come to the Ghostbusters screening on June 11th and ask them questions. And you can also make reservations. That's the Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant, 847-443-3673. And reserve your seats right now for Ghostbusters on June 11th. And that's amctheaters.com. And we'll see you then. It's going to be a really, really fun night. Okay, why don't we take a quick break? When we come back, we got the news, and we're going to talk about what are your favorite late-night TV moments ever. We're going to talk about the most outrageous late-night TV moments of all time. 312-981-7200. That's after the news, which is after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Triple Play Thursday.
Yeah, baby, Triple Play Thursday.
That's one artist, three songs. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Again, that's our second in our CCR / John Fogerty Triple Play. So, hey, before we get to the most outrageous late night TV moments ever, and I want to hear from you guys, what are some of your favorite moments in late night? We can go back a bunch of years. You can be recent about it. What are some of your favorite crazy moments from late night TV? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Before we do that, somebody posted a picture of David Lee Roth on Facebook, and I was like scrolling down. And have you noticed that as David Lee Roth has aged, that he looks exactly like Dr. Smith from Lost in Space? I honestly thought it was Dr. Smith from Lost in Space.
Oh, wow. I didn't know he was still around.
No, he's not.
No?
No, I'm just saying David Lee Roth has aged.
He's starting to
look like Dr. Smith from Lost in Space. I don't see a lot of pictures of present day David Lee Roth that much, but I was like, for a second, man, he looks exactly like Dr. Smith from Lost in Space, which is really a weird thing to think about. You know, if you go back to like 1979 or something and think about David Lee Roth at that time, you would never think that, hey, you know what, man, in about 40 years, he's going to look just like Jonathan, whatever the hell's his last name? Jonathan, the actor who played Lost. Can you look that up for me on the Googles? It's Jonathan.
So you said it was Dr.
Smith.
Dr. Zachary Smith from Lost in Space?
Yeah.
Let's see. Jonathan Harris.
Jonathan Harris, right.
And so, later by Gary Oldman.
Yeah. Let's not talk about the movie. God, William Hurt was in that movie. So was Matt LeBlanc.
That was a choice.
Anyway, that's just an observation I just made scrolling around during the news. I was scrolling around on the old internets and the Facebooks. And saw this picture of David Lee Roth, and I went, man, he looks a lot like Jonathan Harris. I don't know if anybody's ever observed that before, but yeah. You should do a Google search of David Lee Roth present day and see if he looks like... Did you see a picture of Jonathan Harris?
Oh, I see him, yeah.
Well, you know Dr. Smith, right? Yeah, you've seen Lost in Space, of course.
They show it on Saturdays
they
on
do.
TV.
It's on after Sven. It's a lovely night of television right there. But yeah, so I just made that observation during the news. I was like, okay, there you go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right?
Oof.
Right?
Well, I'm not trying to say that Jonathan Harris is certainly a handsome man.
Yeah.
He was a handsome man for his age, but yeah, that's not what I thought David Lee Roth would look like.
No. He looks like Dr. Smith from Lost in Space.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Oh, no, take the boy, not me, you bag of bolts. Oh, He was the biggest wimp in the history of television. He didn't start out that way. It started out, the very first episodes of Lost in Space, he was like the villain, and he was trying to sabotage everything and, like, you know, strand the family or kill the family. He was like a flat-out villain. And then as the show went on, he was just, oh, no, look at the creature.
Just a bumbling idiot.
Yeah. Now, Gary Oldman did play the character like the original intention, like he was like the villain of the piece. And when I saw the movie, I was like, why isn't Gary Oldman going, oh, no, oh?
He could have done it really well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If
actually, he did that in The Professional.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Oh, my God.
Every moment.
I hate that movie. Okay. Outrageous late-night TV shows. Outrageous late-night TV moments. 312-981-7200. And we've got a list here of 30 of them. And there are more than 30, and I'm sure that you guys can dig up some of your favorites. What are some of your favorite crazy late-night TV moments? 312-981-7200. Here's the article in front of me that I am reading from. It says, over the years, late-night hosts have gifted us with magical moments that we won't be forgetting anytime soon. Some cringeworthy, like forced apologies or embarrassing breakdowns. Some hilarious, with long-running bits and scathing takedowns. And some just straight absurd, which is anything to do with Andy Kaufman. For your entertainment, we've gathered the 30 best here. So read on and enjoy. And for more outrageous television spots, be sure to check out the 30 funniest reality show moments of all time. Oh, maybe we can do that sometime.
Yeehaw.
All right. First one that they go to, John Oliver buys a bunch of waxed figure presidents. John Oliver. Oh, how I love thee. Oh, he's just so great. His show is so brilliant and so funny. After the Hall of Presidents and First Ladies Museum, a home to frighteningly realistic wax figures of presidents and first ladies, shut down, John Oliver and the producers behind Last Week Tonight purchased not one but five figures for, according to the Boston Globe, five figures, $13,700 to be precise. The purpose? To make a movie trailer about President Warren G. Harding. So that was the reason why he did it. It's so funny. A lot of stuff that John Oliver has done over the years is pretty spectacular. The whole Russell Crowe thing is just ridiculously funny. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hello. There's a classic. I don't know if it's on your list, but the Johnny Carson show, when Ed Ames taught him how to throw a tomahawk, and he nailed it right into the crotch of the target.
Yeah, that's one of the legendary moments in Tonight Show history. Ed Ames was on with Johnny Carson showing him how to throw an axe, and the target they were throwing. Have you seen this footage?
Yeah.
And the target they were throwing at was like a wooden wall. A wooden target with a man, the shape of a man on it. And when Johnny threw, was it Johnny or Ed Ames? No, it was Ed Ames, I think, who threw it. I think it was Johnny. It was Johnny who threw it. Johnny threw the axe, and it hit the crotch. I mean, right at the crotch of the target. The crotch.
It was classic.
A classic moment. John, thank you for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You know, when they would do anniversary shows, when Johnny Carson would do anniversary shows,
mm-hmm.
like if that, oh, it's our 5th anniversary, 10th anniversary, whatever, that clip would be trotted out every single time.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time. They was like, when are they going to get to the Ed Ames axe-throwing incident? Mm-hmm. And inevitably it would be brought out.
I remember, wasn't there one, and this shows up, I think, on Best of Highlights all the time for the Tonight Show, when he was getting like a massage.
Yeah.
And
Don Rickles.
Yeah, Don Rickles, yeah. Jumps on. I think that does make me laugh every single time.
Don Rickles comes out, and then Johnny ends up throwing, because they had like a whirlpool next to it. Johnny ends up throwing Don Rickles into the whirlpool. There's a lot of great moments, but with Rickles, let me just say something here.
Mm-hmm.
Rickles killed every single time he came on any late night show. He killed all the way up until his death. And he had a lot of memorable moments between Johnny Carson and Don Rickles. And that's definitely one of them. How about this one? David Letterman reveals the blackmailing scheme.
Ooh, I do remember that.
Oh, of course. 2009, David Letterman set aside the bits and got serious. On live television, he admitted to having sexual affairs with his coworkers and subsequently revealed a $2 million blackmail scheme. If Letterman didn't pay up, everyone would learn the truth about his impropriety. The host got in front of the scandal and cooperated with police, eventually leading to the arrest of producer Joe Halderman. I totally remember that.
It was very intense.
It was.
I mean, and I was fairly young at the time. I was, you know, just a freshman in high school. And I was like, whoa, this is, I didn't know this could happen on late night TV.
Yeah.
Something that real.
Yeah. No, it was, and it was a brilliant way for Letterman to get, you know, like they said in the article here, to get in front of it, to take it head on like that. Letterman didn't lose any fans. It did not turn out disastrous for him. He fully admitted that he had affairs, said he was human, revealed the blackmail scheme, and he came out on top in that one. So yeah, that was one of those memorable, outrageous moments. Well, not just again, as the article says, we're not just talking about like the funniest stuff, because that was not funny. That was like a really intense moment, but it does fall into the category of outrageous. So, all right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number on WGN. We want to hear from you guys. What are some of your favorite outrageous late night TV moments? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. We'll jump back into it after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, Triple Play Thursday. You hear me, Triple Play Thursday? That's One Artist, Three Songs, wrapping up CCR Triple Play. And by the way, the fog has rolled in. We're here up on the 18th floor of downtown Chicago on Wacker. And, you know, about 10 minutes ago. Yeah. There you go. Yeah, that's right. For people who don't know, that's actually the music from The Fog, John Carpenter's fantastic movie. That's actually my favorite John Carpenter score.
Oh, it's excellent.
The Fog is my favorite John Carpenter score. I mean, of many. He's done so many great. So that one's my favorite. And I remember when we saw him at Italia Hall, my buddy and I, when he played live with his son and the rest of the band, I was like, if he doesn't play The Fog, I'm going to kill him. You know,
I think it's one of his favorites.
Yeah,
I bet if you asked him, he would list The Fog.
Yeah, but it's really foggy outside, and it rolled in quick because like 10 minutes ago, I looked out the window and it was rainy and it was wet, but now I barely can see anything. So it's foggy, it's wet out there. Be careful, everybody. Hey, coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.
Yeah.
All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking about the most outrageous late-night TV moments of all time. And another one that they include here, this is hilarious, the long-running feud between Matt Damon and Jimmy Kimmel, which is absolutely hilarious. Because every night he says, my apologies to Matt Damon, we didn't have time for him. Every night, that's what he says at the end of the show. And the stuff that has happened between the two of them is just, it's absolutely hilarious. It has at times been so harsh that it's tough to see if it's a satirical routine or real life, but the song, co-written by and co-starring Sarah Silverman, is arguably the most brutal bit. And I effed Matt Damon, and this was at the time Sarah Silverman and Jimmy Kimmel were dating, and the video is hilarious. I mean, it's everywhere on the internet; you can see it. But you know, all of the Matt Damon Jimmy Kimmel stuff is hysterical. It's a running gag that really, really works. And that video with Sarah Silverman is gold. How about this one? 312 area code. 312-981-7200 for your thoughts on your favorite, the most outrageous late night moments. One night on SNL, Elvis Costello was told not to play radio, and started another song until Elvis cursed and they played it. Maybe Nick remembers better. Yeah, we talked about that when we were talking about best SNL moments. It's a memorable one.
Super cool.
Yeah. 312, Letterman once tried to interview Crispin Glover and hilarity ran in the other direction. Well, that's a legendary. I'm sure it's in this article. It's got to be listed in this article. And when he interviewed Crispin Glover, and Crispin Glover came out with a very obvious and weird wig, outrageous clothes, and big giant shoes, and he acted insane. He acted like he was on drugs, and then he kicked at David Letterman. Letterman walked off the stage and went to commercial. When they came back, Crispin Glover was gone. So he did end up coming back on the show. And making amends a few years later, making amends with Letterman. But that was truly one of the most bizarre things ever. Now, I have met and interviewed Crispin Glover several times. And he is a great guy. He is a really, he is a very, very cool guy. He's just eccentric and weird. My ex-wife was in love with him and went to go see all of his weird movies when he was at the Music Box. Because he's a director and he's made some very, very strange films. So, you know, she got to meet him. She has his books and everything. So she was a big fan of his, and I've had him on the show a couple of times. And I asked him about the appearance, and he just kind of hinted that it was like, it was a performance art piece. Like, he did that purposely, just to see, you know, what would happen.
Eat your heart out, Joaquin Phoenix.
Oh, you know, I'll tell you something. I thought that interview was hilarious. When
incredible.
Joaquin Phoenix came out, Letterman was unbelievably funny. But the reason behind that interview became one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life. I can't even remember the name of it. The Casey Affleck directed.
I'm not there.
I hated that movie. I hated every frame of that movie. I wanted to kill both of them.
And I always confuse the title with The Bob Dylan movie,
which is
an amazing movie.
A great film, yes. All right, let's see. We're talking about late night, outrageous late night moments in TV. Two more real quick ones here. Barack Obama slow jams the news. I got to say, this is one of the few things, that, you know, there are a few things that Fallon has done over the years that I find memorable. For the most part, he makes me nuts. Because he's a terrible interviewer. And his bits aren't necessarily very funny. And when he tries to do politics, it just, like, him and Corden should not do Trump jokes or should not do politics. Leave that to Colbert. Leave it to Trevor Noah. Leave it to John Oliver. Leave it to Samantha Bee. Seth Meyers. Let the people who know how to do that brilliantly and intelligently, let them do it. Fallon, just be cute and sing songs and stuff. But Barack Obama in 2012... swung by the Tonight Show to slow jam the news with Jimmy Fallon. And then he did it again in 2016. It was very, very funny. Very funny. And, you know, it's Barack Obama's a funny guy. Very funny guy. I love the fact that at the White House correspondents' dinner, that he let Keegan-Michael Key come out and do the anger, Barack Obama's anger, which just was hilarious. So... all right, here's KJ on WGN. Go ahead, KJ.
Remember when Johnny Carson loved the animals? He always had the one, and he did these stupid things.
Yeah.
He had that squirrel monkey on his head, and I remember, and he sat there and it peed on his head.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Listen, KJ, he was peed on a lot by animals.
It didn't make any difference. I mean, I loved when the animals were on.
Yeah, well, it was gold every time the animals came on. It was great, and late night shows are doing that again now. They've been doing that's a tradition that they do all the time. All the late night shows at some point have somebody come out from a zoo or an animal place and bring out some weird animals, and it's because Carson did it so well. Joan Embry was from the San Diego Zoo, and then Jim Fowler. They were the two people that would come out and bring out the animals, and I mean the monkey on the head with the monkey peeing. Well, you guys remember the Simpsons episode, right?
Yeah.
With Krusty the Clown had his talk show. Why do they call it the urine monkey?
That's actually a pretty good Krusty.
Krusty's one of my favorite characters on the Simpsons. So, KJ, thanks for the call. Yeah, but Carson got peed on and defecated on by many, many animals. Bit by some animals. But it was funny every single time. And Carson was brilliant when they did those bits. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Yeah. I've got two. I told you, producer, I had two, but I got really three. The first one is Dick Cavett when they had Sly and the Family Stone on, and he was so stoned he couldn't even talk.
Yep, I've seen that. I remember that as well. Yeah.
And the second one is Robin Williams and Jonathan Winters. They were on Tonight's Show, mm-hmm. and they just took it over. Carson yeah. had nothing to say for like 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
He just took over the show and ran it with it.
Well, when Robin Williams was one of Johnny Carson's favorite guests of all time, and when Robin Williams came on, Carson would just laugh. He wouldn't even speak. He would just be in tears laughing. And to have those two guys on, you know, and Jonathan Winters being Robin Williams' hero.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. It was pretty amazing to watch.
And the third one was Steve Allen, the man on the street.
Oh, always good.
Always good.
And by the way, Steve, we need to acknowledge that Steve Allen is responsible for creating 90% of the stuff that still exists in late night TV. He created
all
that.
He was the original talk show.
Absolutely.
He was the original Tonight Show.
Absolutely. All right, Mike, thanks.
Yeah.
Got to run. Got to hit the news. Okay, we'll take a break. News is next. Somebody has good taste in Zeppelin songs. That's my favorite Led Zeppelin song of all time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Who picked the Zeppelin?
That was our friend Sam. Wants to get the lead out.
Yeah.
10 years
man,
gone.
Get the lead out, man. Yeah, 10 years gone. That's my favorite Zeppelin song off of Physical Graffiti.
Beautiful, beautiful record.
Great, great, great song.
Led Zeppelin is getting the lead out here in the newsroom, actually, right now.
Are you listening to Zeppelin?
Yes, Led Zeppelin 2, the album.
That's my favorite Zeppelin album.
Dude, this guy in the newsroom. Oh, man.
Yeah, no, well, Vic, tell everybody that you're kind of doing yourself a re-education thing, right?
Okay, well, for those of you who listen on the overnights, you might also be familiar with Patty Vasquez. She jokes about her, quote, appalling lack of musical knowledge. I also share that lack of knowledge, so I kind of started to self-educate.
Yeah.
And I was Googling, you know, and wanted some direction. I went to Google. They turned me on to a Rolling Stones article that listed the top 100 in their opinion, and I think I'm on like 80 something. But
yeah,
anyway, Zeppelin 2 was one of them.
Zeppelin 2 is my favorite Zeppelin album. You have a lot of great music that you're going to be listening to.
Yeah, I've listened to like 20 albums in the last week and 2 days.
Yeah.
I kind of envy that.
Well, Vic always wants to be better.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
That's one thing I know about Vic. All the years that I've known Vic, you know, always wants to do things that will maybe make him more interesting, or do things that that would change him. I've noticed that about you.
Oh,
Vic.
Thanks, Nick. That's cool. I always joke that my saying is I'm usually in the room the most undereducated and over energetic.
Well, you know what? I think it's probably better to be that way, because then you're energized to get educated.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. Yeah.
I walked into the newsroom, because I always walk in the newsroom, chat with Vic a few times, you know, before we get on the air. And I came in the other morning, and I heard Comfortably Numb playing. And, Vic is at his desk writing his news reports and stuff, and just listening you were listening to The Wall.
Right, yeah. Well, I did like that album.
It's a great record.
And if I have to go into editing audio, which happens, I'll pause the album because I want to give it a fair shot.
Right.
And I think I've downloaded so far 3 albums out of the roughly 20.
The ones that you were listening
to. I already have this Led Zeppelin one in iTunes, but I downloaded one by Dusty Springfield,
yes,
who I'd never heard of and I fell in love with, of this album, Dusty in Memphis.
Right, it's a classic record.
Yeah.
Classic record.
Is it, and then two by Aretha Franklin.
There you go. So he's self-educating himself. That was redundant. All right, Vic, thanks, man.
Yes, sir.
Little Led Zeppelin 2. If you want to stop by the newsroom here, 303 Wacker, come on up and you can jam out with Vic in the newsroom blasting Zeppelin 2.
Bring your guitar. I've got one in here already.
All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Back to what we're talking about here. The most outrageous moments in late night TV. What are the ones that you really like? And what are the most memorable for you? Steve says it should be on the list. Drew Barrymore on Letterman. Yeah, it's here. It's in the article. For those people who might not remember, Drew Barrymore showed up on Letterman, danced for him on top of his desk, and then flashed her, flashed him. That's a very memorable moment. Doc says, Nick, a lot of people remember Bobcat Goldthwait setting his chair on fire for at the Tonight Show. It was like one of Leno's last show, and he set the set on fire. But not as many will recall. Jesse James Dupree of Jackal took his chainsaw to the host desk of Tom Green on Tom's show. I recall that. I recall that because I love Tom Green. 773 area code says Carson had Arnold Palmer as a guest, and Carson asked, what does your wife do to give you luck before a tournament? Palmer says, she kisses my balls. Carson responds, that must make your putter flutter. Carson then apologized later. That's from the bakery guy. Sue says, hey, Nick and everyone, the potato chip lady on Johnny Carson in the 1987 segment. We've played the audio on that several times. It was a woman who worked in a potato chip factory, and she was on the conveyor belt line, and she would have get rid of the misshapen or burnt potato chips. So her job was to be like a potato chip inspector, and if they were too dark or if they were misshapen, she would throw them out. But sometimes she would take them and collect them. So she had a potato chip collection, you know, one that looked like Abraham Lincoln and one that looked like a bird and all this other stuff. And she brought it on to Carson's show. And she was showing her potato chips to Carson. And when she turned away to get another chip, Carson had another bowl of potato chips, like actual regular potato chips. And he crunched into one, and she turned and went white because she thought that Carson bit into one of her collected potato chips, and she got very upset, and he finally had to go, no, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry. The whole thing kind of backfired on him because she got so upset, so he had to pull out the bowl of regular potato chips and go, no, look, see, I eat one of these. Your potato chips are fine. Her reaction was, it was crazy. That's another one that they've shown in the past on like some of the best of shows. So there you go. How about this one? Everybody remembers when Kanye West interrupted Taylor Swift at the 2009 Video Music Awards. What people might not know is that during an apology on The Tonight Show, the rapper broke down crying and had a breakdown on live television. Well, that's shocking. Kanye West had a breakdown of some kind? That's a shocker. Oh, God, I remember this. This is what Andy Dick crosses the line with Ivanka Trump. Have you seen this footage?
Yeah.
Andy Dick was loaded. He was
completely
loaded. Way before her father kicked off his 2016 presidential campaign, Ivanka Trump appeared on Jimmy Kimmel Live alongside Andy Dick. Throughout the interview, Dick kept inappropriately touching Trump to the point that he had to be carted off the stage by security while cameras were still rolling. They actually picked him up. Three guys came out, picked him up, and carried him out of the studio. All right. Here's Robert on WGN. Hi, Robert.
Good morning, Nicholas. I had a question for you. Now, I'm 60 years old, so I'm one of the old farts. But on Johnny Carson, you had Art Donovan, who would even Johnny Carson start to swear. But with, like, Drew Carey, my brother lives in Huntington Beach on the ocean, and I've met him a few times, and he told me that his first appearance on Johnny Carson changed his entire life.
Oh, it's true.
Okay, and so my question to you is, and I don't know this, but when Jay Leno took over, I don't think he had the same kind of power that Johnny Carson had. Johnny Carson could make or break.
Oh, there's no question about it. Nobody but Carson had that kind of power. And
even in today's world, I don't think the late night people who are on television now have that kind of power.
Well,
where they
it's
can make
not,
one
you know what,
phone
it's,
call,
it's,
and next thing you know, you're
Robert,
booked in Vegas for years.
It's an entirely different landscape now. There were only three networks when Johnny Carson was on. Now you've got Comedy Central. You got showcases for you got Netflix where comedians can go. There are so many different channels and so many different cable and streaming possibilities for stand up comedians. It's an entirely different world. Back then, if you got on Carson, if you booked a Carson, that was a massive deal. If Carson liked you and gave you the thumbs up, or asked you over to the couch, if you got to go over to the couch. And Drew Carey's first appearance, he got the couch. He got the call over to the couch. And yeah, that changed his whole career. But again, the landscape was a lot different. But it is absolutely true, though, Robert. Nobody had the power that Johnny Carson had, especially when it came to breaking stand-up comedians. Nobody did.
Well, that's the information I wanted to hear. Again, you have the best show, bar none, on any radio station anywhere in the United States.
That's really
kind of why?
Me.
Because you do not bring politics in anything. You don't. Once in a great while.
Yeah.
But other than that, anyone can turn on this dial and you get the best shows. But especially your show.
I appreciate that, Robert. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
All right.
Take care.
Have a great night,
right,
buddy.
Take care. Yeah, that was nice. Here's the thing. It's not like I don't have a political opinion, because I do, and I think a lot of people know where my politics lie. But I would like to break away from that. That's not what this show's about. It's not like I'm not well read. It's not like I don't have political concerns about what's happening in the world right now. It's not like I don't have an opinion on any of that stuff. It's just that my show is not that. My personal life, I'm all about politics, and I follow everything. And I've talked before about, you know, like we're talking late night comedy. The guys that I lean towards clearly have an opinion that I side with. You know, I watch Colbert and I watch John Oliver and these guys and Seth Meyers. And I kind of on that politically, that's where I stand. But I'm not going to, you know, get on some sort of like a, you know, pedestal and start screaming about politics on the show. That's not what I do. Every once in a while, we'll do it. Every once in a while. You know, it was one of the hardest shows I've ever had to do in my lifetime.
Which one?
Was the night that Trump got elected, because his concession, or not his speech, came on about 20 minutes before I had to go on. And so I spent, like, we couldn't ignore it.
Right.
So we spent, like, the whole night talking about it. Most of the night talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to at that point.
Oh, of course, you can't. I mean, that's the story.
It's
a
pivotal moment, no matter who you are.
Yeah.
It reminds me, I remember hardest show I ever had to do was we got the call that John McCain had died the Saturday night before Dean's show. And obviously, it's a four-hour show. That's booked in advance.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's Saturday night, and I'm cold calling Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth, and like, would you like to say something? And it was, it was a very interesting,
show. That happened to me when I was doing Saturday nights. Andy and I had, you know, my Saturday night show was 4 hours. Sometimes it was 5 hours
long. Yeah, yeah.
And we had everything booked. We had guests and everything like that. Paul Harvey died.
Wow.
Like a half an hour before we went on.
Holy cow.
And we were calling everybody. We were calling Roy. We called Spike. We called everybody. We got a hold of people from the family. And we put together a full tribute to Paul Harvey in about a half an hour. And also, we had Matt Mantucci was here, and he stuck around. He was a part-time producer. Creed fan. He was our Creed contact. And he stuck around and helped out and helped Andy make phone calls and pull audio. And we ended up doing a really great Paul Harvey show.
All right.
And that was at the time when during the darkness, when we had questionable management here at WGN. Very, very, very questionable management here at WGN. Mm-hmm. And I did not get a thank you at all. Nothing.
Oh.
And it was a tough show, man. It was a hard show.
I believe it.
The other times that have been really, really hard, the first show I did after Roy died was ridiculous.
I mean, what are the words you even find at that point?
I mean, Todd called me, our boss here, Todd called me and said, look, if you want to take the night off, take the night off. Because I found out that Roy died around 11 o'clock. And so Todd called me and said, look, if you want to take the night off, I could totally understand. I'm like, no, I got to be on the air.
Right.
I have to be on the air. I have to talk about Roy. And I did. It was hard. I cried a bunch of times during the show. And then the first show that anybody had to do after 9/11, was insane. Especially the kind of show that I do. As we just said, it's not very political, and I try to keep it light and try to keep it funny. That was a really, really hard show to come back after 9/11. It was 4 days after 9/11 when we had to come back on and do a show. Mm-hmm. So So those were hard times. But anyway, I try to keep it light, and that's what we're doing tonight. We're talking about the most outrageous late-night TV show moments of all time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We'd love to hear you talk or text. 312-981-7200. More after this. I would like to thank who
I'm sorry. That was Sam.
Sam. Yeah. I'd like to thank Sam again for picking Deep Cuts, you know, not going with like Stairway or Whole Lot of Love. And there's nothing wrong with those songs.
No, no.
But all right. Very cool. Triple Play Thursday.
Yeah.
With Zeppelin. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We're talking about some of the most outrageous moments of late night TV. How about this one? Madonna drops 14 F-bombs in one interview. Hey, Madonna's four nights at the Chicago Theater in October.
Are those on sale yet?
I'm not sure. I know I'm going.
I really want to go.
Have you ever seen Madonna?
I've never seen Madonna.
Oh, man.
And I even turned to my girlfriend. I was like, she'll want to see Madonna. I was like, hey, you want to go to see Madonna at the Chicago Theater? She's like, what? Why? I've never listened to Madonna in my life. I'm like, well, okay, then I'm not buying you a ticket.
And to see her in the Chicago Theater is going to be amazing.
One of
because
my favorite
I've only seen her in like stadiums or like arenas, like big arenas. I mean, that's why she's doing four nights, is because it's a smaller venue. And to see Madonna at the Chicago Theater is going to be unbelievable. It's going to be unbelievable. I'm going, and I know I'm going at least one night or multiple. I don't know, but I'm going.
I could probably afford one night.
Man, oh,
how
man.
Much are those tickets going to be?
I don't know.
Hundreds.
Lots of money. Lots of money. So, but in one single interview, Madonna dropped 14 F-bombs, setting an all-time record for the most censored late-night interview of all time. In years since, censorship laws have loosened up, but so no one's counting. Yeah. That was, and she was smoking a cigar. She has a fantastic relationship with Letterman. Like, when she was on with Letterman, it was always great. It was always fantastic. That night, I remember watching it and just I would laugh my butt off. I thought it was so funny. How about this? Andy Kaufman panhandles on Letterman. In a routine that is, in hindsight, obviously satirical, Andy Kaufman's legendary panhandling bit wasn't initially viewed as such, with folks in the audience actually reaching into their coffers and handing over cash to the comic. Andy Kaufman, man. Stephen Colbert bids adieu to Bill O'Reilly. Stephen Colbert and Bill O'Reilly have a long history, but appeared on each other's shows, usually for the purpose of throwing moral pot shots. But upon O'Reilly's dismissal from Fox News, Colbert was able to get the last word in, and he truly held no punches in a collection of incredible great burns. That I remember that. That was really weird. Very strange to watch. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hey, hi. Hello. I have a classic moment from the Jay Leno show. Remember when he went out in the street to interview people?
Yeah.
Okay. This one, it was a warm, sunny day in L.A. You could see the U.S. flag in the background, you know, blowing in the wind. And Jay Leno asked her, how many stars are on that flag? And she says, I don't know. I can't count them. The flag is moving.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
That is dumb.
All right. All right, Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
Take care. I hated that segment.
I'm a sucker for man on the street stuff.
Yeah, but that you know, Kimmel does a similar thing too, and I don't like it.
You don't like lie witness news?
No, I don't.
Oh. I like when he goes to Coachella and does
lie witness news, you know, it bothers me. I don't know why. I don't know why. And here I'm a fan of Tom Green. I'm a fan of Andy Kaufman, which is sort of like similar kind of, you know, humor where you're blindsiding someone. But I just don't. I don't know. And especially Jay on the street really bothered me. I mean, the Kimmel, because I like Kimmel. The Kimmel thing it bothers me. But Jay on the street used to make me nuts. And I never really watched Leno because I can't stand Leno.
Yeah, I didn't like Leno.
But I would see those bits every once in a while, and it was just like, hey, look how stupid this person is. You know?
Well, for me,
I don't know. I mean, it rubbed me the wrong way.
I get that.
And the Kimmel thing, the Live Witness News, it just makes me. I just like, man, I don't want to watch this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like the one where it's like where they have a world map and they're like point to a country. You know, that on the same level, it doesn't bother me as much as Live Witness News.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It's just especially Jay on the street, because one of the reasons why is because I think Jay Leno's an idiot. So like for him to go out on the street and make people look like idiots, yeah, I'm like, yeah. Okay, no, it just bothers me. I don't know. It's a hang up for me. Everybody else enjoys it. I just kind of get
I
get uncomfortable watching it.
I really don't think you're all that alone.
Yeah,
and it depends on what they're doing, but the Coachella ones make me laugh because. You know, it's kind of like why people laughed at the Fyre Festival people, because they're like, this is some of the most privileged people on earth.
Yeah.
And they don't know anything.
Yeah.
You know, they're just like, oh, yeah, you want to come in to see Monkey Shines?
I understand why it's funny. You know what I mean? And I understand why people think it's funny. It makes me uncomfortable.
Fair
enough. I don't know if that makes me, you know, kept and sensitive. I don't know.
But you do like the Tom Green stuff.
I do.
I wonder what the division is.
Most of the Tom Green stuff, he's doing it to his parents, which is, for me, there's something about that's okay. I don't know why.
Like when he paints the car.
And he would play, oh my God, one of the funniest things ever. But you know, like he would prank people on the streets and stuff like that. But for some reason, I don't know why I thought that was always funny. You know what it is? I don't think Tom Green would do weird stuff to people and strangers on the street, but it didn't make them look stupid.
It made him look stupid.
If anything, it made him look stupid.
There it is.
And I think that's the difference. So, all right. Captain Sensitive needs to take a break and cry now. All right, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up after this. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above a very wet and not quite as foggy. The fog seems to have rolled away a little bit, cleared up a little bit. I can actually see out the window. There was a period of time where up here on the 18th floor, you couldn't see it. You couldn't see anything. Still wet out there. Be careful. Phone number is 312-981-7200, and that covers up our Triple Play Thursday collection of Led Zeppelin. Yeah! So you get your requests in, Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. All right, we are talking about some of the most outrageous and memorable late-night TV moments, and there are plenty. And if you guys want to jump in, talk or text, it's 312-981-7200. How about this one? This was amazing. John Oliver buys and forgives medical debt. During one particularly noteworthy episode of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, the hostess Mostis himself bought up an insane amount of debt to the tune of $15 million, to be exact, and decided to forgive it all. Unbelievable. Pretty unbelievable moment. Arnold Schwarzenegger kicks off a run for governor. Arnold Schwarzenegger is true Hollywood to Washington fashion, announced his run for governor in rapturous applause on The Tonight Show. He ended up serving two full terms in office from 2003 to 2011. And he announced that on The Tonight Show. How about this one? Jay Leno grills Hugh Grant. In 1995, Hugh Grant found himself in legal hot waters for engaging in sexual activity in a public place. During his first post-arrest interview with Jay Leno, he refused to treat Grant with kid gloves, kicking off the questions with a savage, "What were you thinking?" I do remember that. That made all the news. Now we finally get to some Craigie Ferg. Finally. By the way, I'm reading his new book, and it's fantastic. He's just, I love him. Craig Ferguson Becomes a Citizen. That was fantastic. Glasgow-born Craig Ferguson aired his own attempt at taking the United States citizenship test on The Late Late Show. He passed with flying colors, having answered every single question correctly. If you're making a list of like really memorable late night TV shows, late night TV moments, the entire list could consist of Craig Ferguson moments. As far as
great stuff.
Here's David on WGN. Hey, David.
Yeah, I remember Johnny Carson propositioning Dolly Parton. I think it was back when she was doing 9 to 5.
Yeah,
the movie, and he offered her $1 million to play underneath her dress. Well, and she's like, "Do I have to be wearing it?" And he's like, "Yes." And she's like, "What's your wife going to say? Oh, number 4 is at home. Would you like to be number 5?"
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were a million jokes about how many times Carson was married. They used to do jokes about Carson getting married all the time. And of course, Ed got divorced a few times too. So he and Doc got divorced, if I'm not mistaken. So all three of those guys went through at least one or multiple divorces, and those were always very funny jokes. Yeah,
yeah. But I think that was the last time Dolly was on Carson.
Yeah,
I don't think she went back.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. All right, David. Thanks for the call. What he actually said to her was, obviously, Dolly Parton is very well endowed. We all know that. And he said something to the effect of, "I'd give 2 years' salary to see something under your shirt," or something to see under your shirt. And I think she busted out laughing. But it was something about how much money he would give to look under her shirt. That was the that was the general gist of it. All right. Here's Francis on WGN. Hi, Francis.
Hey, how are you this morning?
All right.
I remember, I told the young man who asked the phone, I'm up there in age. I'm like the guy who said he's the old guy. I'm older than him. And I remember an episode of The Tonight Show where Jerry Lewis was hosting.
Yeah.
And he did a road kind of thing like the 12 Days of Christmas, only it wasn't the 12 Days of Christmas. It started off one hen, two ducks, three squawking geese, and it went all the way to 12. And my dad had a good memory for it. He learned it. And ever since then, it's been a part of our family tradition to recite these. And he even updated, like, it was roller skates. He changed it to precision roller skates. But it was always, I always remember that because we stayed up for a week. And he came on and he did this thing every day for a week. And we never got to stay up late. So we got to stay up late just to watch Jerry Lewis do his rote. And it was just so much fun. And I'm just going to add to what the young man said about it's enjoyable. I know, you're political. Everybody's political. But it's just nice to turn on a station and have a break. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
From the stress.
Yeah.
And just have a time where you can just learn this and enjoy it. And even when you bring up the people who we love who passed on, that's still a good memory. So you guys, a WGN is just awesome all the way around as far as I'm concerned.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Francis. I appreciate that.
You guys have a nice morning.
All right,
now.
You too. Okay.
Bye.
All right, bye. There you go. That's very nice. Got some texts here. 708 area code says, I don't remember if it was on The Tonight Show, but Andy Kaufman came on to announce that he was dying of cancer, and no one was sure if it was a bit. I don't think he lived much longer. Everybody thought it was a joke. Everybody thought when Andy Kaufman said he was sick and he was dying of cancer, everybody thought, well, this is a bit. And even when he died, even after he died, people were like, when is he going to come back? And it would, you know, people were convinced that it was like going to be the ultimate prank that Andy Kaufman was going to play on people. But in fact, he did die. 847 area code says, I love your show, Nick. I've been listening since at least 2002. Oh, thank you. You're the best DJ in Chicago. Well, I'm not really a DJ. Yeah, man! But I thank you for that. I appreciate that. That's a long time to be listening to an idiot like me. So many memories and a memorable Carson late night bits. Maybe you already mentioned the episode where Burt Reynolds and Johnny Carson sprayed whipped cream on each other. It was hilarious. That all started. Dom DeLuise is the one who started that because Dom DeLuise came out before Burt Reynolds. This was Burt Reynolds at his 70s glory. Brown tight leather pants, brown leather jacket. But Dom DeLuise did like an egg trick before Burt Reynolds came out. And it was like this trick where he had a broom and he was pressing down on the bristles part of the broom, holding the handle back. And he would let go of the handle. The handle would fly and hit a thing that was holding six eggs over six different glasses of water. And the idea was that the broom handle would smack, the thing would fly out, and all six of the eggs would go into the water. And it worked, but they started throwing eggs at each other. So it started with Dom DeLuise whipping eggs at Johnny, and Johnny whipping eggs at Dom DeLuise and smashing eggs on top of their heads and stuff like that. And then Burt Reynolds comes out, and he's got a can of whipped cream. And he starts spraying whipped cream, on Johnny and then down his pants. And then Johnny, sprayed. And it went on. It was just this insane bit. That happened a lot, though. I mean, every time Burt Reynolds came on, it was pretty crazy. Canadian Bill says, Harvey Pekar on David Letterman, a love-hate relationship. And Andy Kaufman and Jerry Lawler, how many people bought that? That's a Canadian Bill. The Harvey Pekar stuff, for anybody who's not seen American Splendor with Paul Giamatti, that movie is about Harvey Pekar, who would show up on Letterman. And it was always, there were always weird visits. Okay, let me ask you a question. Tom, have you ever seen any appearances on Letterman with Brother Theodore?
No.
Have you seen The Burbs?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Course. You know the guy who plays the Klopek, the oldest Klopek?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why he was parked out front all day. That's Brother Theodore.
Oh, God.
Okay, so Brother Theodore was this performance artist who would do a lot of stage performance art. He had this character, Brother Theodore. He did a radio show. And he was a New York performance artist. And he was insane. And his appearances on Letterman are unbelievable. If you want to go down, a YouTube wormhole, go down the Brother Theodore David Letterman wormhole, because it's unbelievable. His appearances were legendary on Letterman. Letterman would egg him on. He was the audience loved him, and
I see he's from Dusseldorf.
Yeah, well, you have to see this guy to believe. You've seen him
in the Burbs.
You saw him in the Burbs, and that's not far from what he did in real life. He was even crazier. I love the scene when they go visit the Klopeks, and when they go up to knock on the door, and Bruce Dern's got the brownies, and his foot goes through the floor on the porch, and he drops the brownie. Goes, there goes the damn brownies. And they're trying to they want to be neighborly, and they go in there, and Courtney Gaines is in there, and then Henry Gibson comes up from down in the basement. That movie, by the way, is genius. The Burbs, it's genius. But my favorite part of that scene is when Courtney Gaines goes, sardine, and he offers the sardine to Tom Hanks, and he puts it on a press. He gives him a pretzel to put this big sardine on, and Tom Hanks, they're like, go ahead and eat it. Carrie Fisher is like encouraging him to eat the sardine, which of course looks and smells disgusting. And while he's trying to eat the sardine, in the background, because Tom Hanks is in the foreground of the shot with the sardine, and in the background is just Brother Theodore just staring at him. An unbreakable, crazy Brother Theodore stare at Tom Hanks as he's trying to eat the sardine. That movie...
Underappreciated.
Oh, my God.
From a very different time than people my age would remember of Tom Hanks.
Yeah, no. I mean, that, and it was a complete failure when it came.
Right.
Bomb. And, I'm not crazy about the ending. I think we've talked about this.
We have, yeah.
They should not have been killers.
No.
The whole movie is about suburban paranoia. You know what I mean? They should have been innocent. That's
right.
The ending should not have been confirmed, what the neighbors thought, because what the whole movie was about led up to them being innocent.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a weird movie to watch when I think of Tom Hanks as the voice of Woody the Cowboy.
Sure.
That and Bachelor Party.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You ever see The Man with One Red Shoe?
Yep.
All right. We got to take a break here. We got the news or weather here. And then we'll come back and we've got a lot more really, really memorable and outrageous late night TV shows to talk about or moments.
Change, change, change.
Follow you.
was this just a coincidence that this was also an artist that that Vic is discovering? Did that request come in before we started talking about Vic?
It came in literally before the show even started.
That's crazy that we had Zeppelin.
I know.
And now Aretha Franklin. And those are two artists that that Vic is educating himself about.
They're speaking to you, Vic.
It's amazing.
They want you to listen.
That's exactly right. Who requested that for Triple Play Thursday?
That's coming to us from a longtime listener and good friend, Rasco.
All right, Rasco. Thanks, buddy. Triple Play Thursday, yeah! 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Got more of that coming up. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on WGN. 847 area code. We are talking about some outrageous and very memorable late night TV moments. 847 area code says, Nick, I loved it when Craig Ferguson went around Paris for a week with Kristen Bell. It was hilarious. Craig's imitation of Sean Connery holding a baguette in Paris was nuts. It was priceless. We spent some time earlier or late last week talking about Craig Ferguson and how he is so missed in the late night world, and some of the stuff that he did was so brilliant, and you know, so many amazing moments. Let's see, here's Bill on WGN. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, Nick, do you remember when Johnny Carson introduced Tiny Tim with Tiptoe Through the Tulips?
Well, yeah, but the bigger thing was when Tiny Tim got married to Miss Vicky on the Tonight Show. On the Tonight Show, and it was the highest rated Tonight Show of all time at that time.
Yeah, I know. I forgot about the wedding on there.
Yeah,
right. And
yeah.
Another thing, do you remember Sammy Davis Jr. came on one night dressed in a cowboy outfit wearing two guns?
Yes.
And he did that gun trick. Did you ever see him do that?
Oh, absolutely.
He pulled the guns and up over his back and all that stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a ridiculous fan of old Johnny Carson shows. I just think they're fantastic. And nobody was better than Johnny Carson. And especially at what he did. They were
these new guys, you know, Kimmel and all the others, they still can't beat Carson.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love there are a lot of guys who are in late night TV right now that I think are brilliant and great, but Carson is the godfather, man. He's the man. He is,
right,
no question
right
about it. All right, Bill, thank you.
Okay.
Here's Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hey, Nick, how you doing?
All right.
I thought of two that they're not so much outrageous as they are kind of bittersweet. I've never forgotten them. You probably haven't either. One of them was Letterman interviewed Warren Zevon.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, his very last appearance.
Yep.
And he was dying. That was
no. Well, it was amazing. The last appearance of Warren Zevon. The thing about Letterman was Warren Zevon was one of his favorite artists, if not his favorite artist of all time. A music artist of all time, and everybody who listens to this show on a regular basis knows how I feel about Warren Zevon. There were times whenever Paul would take off, Paul Schaefer would take off. I remember, I think it happened twice. So for two separate weeks, Paul Schaefer was off for the week. Warren Zevon, he would have Warren Zevon as the band leader.
And
they had a great relationship. They had a great relationship, and the final appearance that he had, it was heartbreaking.
Zevon had this way of just sort of sloughing off you.
Oh yeah,
you know, and it was lighthearted. And in the same vein, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was Carson. Didn't he interview Michael Landon?
Yeah, he did.
Like about a week before he passed away.
Yeah, he interviewed Landon, and Landon was sick as well.
And it was the same thing about like kind of laughing about it.
Yeah,
you know, and it was just, it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And Landon was just putting his best face forward and trying to joke it off.
Well,
but,
the thing about Warren Zevon was, you know, he had established that kind of sardonic, sense of humor throughout his career. And even while he was dying, he was still had that dark, you know, like really, really great sensibility of comedy. Now it was heartbreaking when he went. Real sad time. So
yeah.
All right, Rich. Thank you, buddy.
You bet. Take care.
How about Nicole Kidman retroactively breaks Jimmy Fallon's heart? Do you know this?
Yeah.
Nicole Kidman revealed to Fallon in 2015 that when they first met, she had hoped the romance would blossom between the two of them. Of course, this devastated Fallon, who ended up retreating to the onset couch in exasperation. It's a really funny story. It's a really funny story. Somebody called up Fallon, and this was, you know, he was living in like an apartment, you know, in Manhattan. I think this was just when he was doing SNL. He was on SNL. And this guy says, hey, his friend says, hey, Nicole Kidman's here. You mind if we come over? And he's like, oh, yeah, sure. So he brings Nicole Kidman over, and he's playing, and Jimmy Fallon is like playing video games and not getting the hint at all that Nicole Kidman wanted to be alone with him and had, you know, and so the last time Nicole Kidman was on Fallon, one of the last times, what the hell's her, Keith Urban, right? Okay, yeah, Keith Urban. Keith Urban comes out while they were having the discussion. Keith Urban comes out and sits down, and everything gets very, very awkward at that point. So, all right, we got a break here for the news, and then we'll come back. We've got more outrageous or memorable late night TV moments to share right here on 720 WGN. News is up after this. Baby, sweet baby. Go. Triple Play Thursday continues. Yeah, me a Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200. Did you hear that, Vic? You heard who that was? That was Aretha Franklin.
I wasn't paying attention. That I missed Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing. What's weird is that request came in before the show, and so did the Zeppelin request. So that's two artists that you were educating yourself about that have been featured on Triple Play Thursday this morning by coincidence.
That's amazing.
Isn't that unbelievable? You got to love my listeners, man. They know everything before we know everything. And I don't know anything. I don't even know what the hell's going on. Hi! Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio in a wet downtown Chicago here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows at 5 with the opening bell and the great Steve Cochran at 6, who has your morning drive. And we have been having a lot of fun talking about these late-night TV moments. What are some of your favorites? You can text us or call us at 312-981-7200. So famous and crazy and outrageous and very, very memorable late-night TV moments. Text now or call now, 312-981-7200. We mentioned Drew Barrymore flashing David Letterman. That was in 1995. She jumped up on his desk, did a little dance, and flashed him. Real Time with Bill Maher host Bill Maher crossed all the lines by referring to himself using the forbidden word, the most forbidden word in the English language. I totally remember that. How about this one? Michael Richards attempts an apology after tanking his career by calling an audience member the worst word in the English language during a stand-up routine in 2006. Michael Richards went on The Late Show with David Letterman to issue an apology. Richards' subsequent two television roles involved three-episode stints on Curb Your Enthusiasm and Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and that was 2009-2014, respectively. That apology by Michael Richards is really one of the most awkward things that I've ever seen on a late night show. What happened was Jerry Seinfeld was a guest on Letterman's show, and the whole insane Michael Richards stand-up stage meltdown with the N-word flying out of his mouth had just happened. It had happened like two, three days earlier, and it broke big time on the internet and across, you know, all over the place. And so, you know, obviously, you know, it basically ended Michael Richards' career, but he tried to save face. I remember he met with, if I'm not mistaken, he met with African-American leaders like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson to try and smooth things out. And he, so what happened was Letterman was, or Seinfeld was in studio with Letterman. He's being interviewed by Letterman. And then, via satellite on a screen, he's in LA, Michael Richards pops up and awkwardly and painfully tries to make an apology. The audience started laughing, and at one point Jerry Seinfeld said, hey, it's not funny. And he got angry, and at one point, you know, during the apology he referred to black people as Afro-Americans. And it was just like, no, stop, dude. I mean, you know, just stop. You're, you know, get put the shovel down because you're continuing to dig yourself into a bigger hole than you already are in, if that's possible. I remember watching that and squirming, just squirming on my couch going, man, don't, what are you doing? I will tell you this, the Curb Your Enthusiasm stretch that they did where they had the Seinfeld reunion and, you know, because they were talking about, because they wanted to get the finale, right. Because they screwed the finale up so much. You know, the fact that Michael Richards came back for that. And they did not shy away from making jokes about that incident where he dropped the N-word a bunch of times on stage at a comedy club. They made jokes about it. And they were very, it was very funny. That whole subplot about Larry David basically bringing back Seinfeld so that he could cast Cheryl in it to try and get back together with her was genius. And the episodes that the fake Seinfeld episodes that were written for that stretch were funnier than anything they did in the last season of Seinfeld. Because the last season of Seinfeld, with a few exceptions, is not very good. I mean, you know, I mean when Larry David left the show, the quality of the show dropped a lot, and you can see it in the final two seasons. There's a huge difference. But yeah, I remember watching that thing that Michael Richards and that attempt at an apology, and it was just painful. Really, 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 really painful. Let's see. Here's Marie on WGN. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
Hi.
I was watching Johnny Carson one night, and Buddy Hackett was on, which he's on various times.
Yeah.
And he kept referring to a joke about a Chinese doctor. And finally, Johnny Carson said to him, if you bring that up again, you will no longer be on my show and that you will not be my friend any longer. Well, my husband and I went to see Buddy Hackett at the Star Theater in Maryville, Indiana, and he told that joke about the Chinese doctor, and it was the most filthiest joke I have ever heard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what people realize is that Buddy Hackett worked blue. He was,
yes, he did.
Filthy, and nobody knew that from his appearances on talk shows and on Carson. He was like this sort of chubby, adorable, with that great voice, that fun little voice, and he always was, you know, very nice and funny on the shows. And, you know, he was in Herbie the Love Bug and all that stuff.
Yeah.
He was this lovable guy. You go see this guy live, and he was filthy. He was one of the dirtiest comedians of all time.
Well, I was embarrassed to sit there, I'm telling you.
Marie, he embarrassed you. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right, Marie, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. It's like Saget.
Yeah.
It's because Saget, you know, on Full House,
uh-huh.
America's Funniest Home Videos, two shows that are aimed specifically at families and kids and stuff like that. People would go and see him live and go, this will be really funny. And he filthy comedian.
And Saget, he's great, but he's a psycho.
Oh, yeah, he's nuts. He's nuts.
I was working at the Rao Center for the Arts in Crystal Lake. That used to be my job. I used to be like a hand, you know, helping out in that place. And Bob Saget came, and he did. And we were all like really excited. We were like, oh, man, it's Danny Tanner. It's Danny Tanner, man. He's coming to the Rao. And he was very respectful, you know, of all the stage people and everything like that. But we were watching him from backstage, and we were blushing. And we were we were like 17, 18-year-old guys, and we were like, whoa.
I can't tell you the number of stories that circulated about people being, like, unbelievably offended because the guy from Full House and America's Funniest Home Videos is vile and offensive and filthy.
I think most of the audience there was on it, pretty upset.
You know, Bob Saget directed Dirty Work.
Wait, he directed?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
No, okay. He directed Dirty Work. Bob Saget directed Dirty Work.
Oh, my God.
And for people who don't, come on, man. I love Norm MacDonald. I mean, I love the man. So people who might not know what Dirty Work is, Dirty Work is a comedy that was co-written and starring the great Norm MacDonald, and Saget directed it. Bob Saget directed it. and it stars Norm MacDonald and Artie Lang as a couple of guys who start a company where they will do the uncomfortable stuff for you. They will do the mean stuff for you. They will do the dirty work for you. And so Saget directed that movie. And I don't know if it's the only movie he's ever directed. I think it might be the only movie that Bob Saget's ever directed. But yeah, he directed Dirty Work. And so one of the funniest things that I've ever... Because Artie Lang is in the... is in Dirty Work, and so they talk about the day that he was on Howard Stern. Obviously, as you know, Artie Lang, a regular, a sidekick on Howard Stern for many years, and so they were talking about Don Rickles because he's in Dirty Work. He's got one scene in Dirty Work, and he did it because Saget knew him, and so they talk about. On this Howard Stern clip, which is available online if you want to get it. And they talk about what it was like to work with Rickles just for the one day. And so Artie Lang tells this unbelievable story about Rickles just on the set, and they only had him for one day because they were like paying him by the hour or something. They had to get, this was a low-budget movie. They had to get him in, get him out. And he improvised like almost everything that he said. And at one point, Norm MacDonald couldn't stop laughing. Like, he was laughing and, like, ruining takes and stuff. So you can see in the movie, if you watch the clip in the movie, Norm MacDonald is laughing. And so, you think it's funny? And Rickles goes after him. And he walks up to Artie Lang and he goes, "Look at you, you baby gorilla." That's the first thing he says to him. And to hear this audio from Stern show, of Artie Lang telling the story, and then they play the audio of the clip from the movie. It is absolutely hilarious, and the stories about what Don Rickles was like on that set. So that's Saget's directorial debut. That would be Dirty Work. Do you like Screwed as well? Have you seen Screwed?
Yeah.
Okay,
I do.
You want to hear one of the greatest line readings in the history of film? That's one of the greatest line readings in the history of film. That's the great Elaine Stritch.
Oh, she's amazing.
Who's in Screwed. And you know that on the page, it just says, "Who cares?" on the script. And she did this.
Who cares?
It's one of the greatest. It's one of my favorite line readings of all time. Screwed is not as good as Dirty Work. Dirty Work is better.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dirty Work is better. Chris Farley with the dead hookers in the trunk of the car. Come on, man. All right, we got a break, and when we come back, we've got some more great late-night TV moments, memorable ones, outrageous ones. What are your favorites? Which ones do you remember? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200.
What you want, baby, I got. What you need, you know I got it. All I'm asking is for a little respect when you come home. Just a little bit, hey, baby, just a little bit.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. You're Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And welcome back. We've been talking about memorable and outrageous moments that everybody remembers from late-night TV. And if you want to jump in with any of that, we'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Here's Tom on WGN. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, Nick. Like I was telling your producer, I'm not sure who the host was even on this, but it was Penn and Teller with a guest, and Penn put this box on in the middle of the middle of the desk, and then picked it up real quick, and the box was full of cockroaches.
Oh.
And they all scattered. But he had, before the show, put adhesive all around the edge of the desk. So as soon as they all hit the edge of the desk, they stopped. And it was like they knew, you know how they do magic like that, goofy magic.
Oh, but, yeah.
They knew whoever it was. They knew the host that was definitely afraid of bugs. I can't, that maybe somebody else knows who it was. But
Tom, I found it for you. It was on Letterman.
Letterman. Yeah, they knew he was definitely afraid of bugs. And I guess he was. Letterman said, "You're never coming back."
Oh yeah, no, you don't do that stuff to Dave, man. You don't pull that kind of stuff with Dave.
Yeah, he jumped like you wouldn't believe. And I don't know why I couldn't remember it was Letterman, just because it was so shocking. You know, nobody expected it.
Yeah.
Big, hissing cockroaches, too.
Sure. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I'll have to go back and watch that. All right, Tom, thanks, buddy.
All right. Bye-bye.
I love Penn and Teller.
They're super funny, and they're very smart.
I got to do a trick with them on stage.
Wow, nice.
Yeah. I was part of, like, five people that were pulled up out
sure,
of the audience.
Sure.
And this was in New York. I saw him in New York on Broadway like three or four times, and saw him here in Chicago. Got to meet him. Have you ever seen Penn and Teller get killed?
No.
Dude,
is that just a special?
No, it's a movie. Arthur Penn directed it.
Wait, what?
Yeah,
Bonnie and Clyde. Arthur
yes,
Penn.
Yes.
When was this?
1989.
Oh my God.
Something like that. It is. Great and really dark. I remember when Penn Jillette was on with Roy. Roy was, because when Roy had certain specific guests on, he was like, you like these people more than I do. Why don't you come down and sit on the interview? You know what I mean? He would do that all the time. Whenever he had anybody from the horror genre on, you know, I was always there, you know, to sit in on the interview. Like one insane morning, this is absolutely true. One insane morning, Roy, because Roy, whenever any celebrities or stars came to town, they always did Roy's show. Like when they came to town to do publicity, one of your major, major stops on your publicity tour that day, you do Roy Leonard's show. That's it. Publicists knew it. Agents knew it. When you're in town, you're promoting something in the world of entertainment, you do Roy Leonard's show. You have to. So one morning, and this was completely insane. He has Clive Barker on. Okay, so I'm there for Clay. He had Clive Barker on three times. I've met Clive Barker and interviewed him three times.
I can't even imagine what that's like.
I gave him two of my books of his, and he did special drawings like art. You know how he does art. He did like a special exclusive drawing in two of my books that he signed. Prized possessions right there. So anyway, he comes in, we're interviewing him, and it had to be the first Hellraiser. So we were talking about the first Hellraiser, and Roy's next guest, who was scheduled to be on, showed up a little bit early, and Clive Barker decided that he was having such a good time with us that he was going to stay late. And that next guest who came in and joined in on the conversation was John Cleese.
Wait, John Cleese came in and sat in.
John Cleese, Clive Barker, me, Roy.
Good Lord.
Cleese was, I love Clive Barker, love him. John Cleese is one of my heroes. John Cleese is one of the comedy heroes of my life. And he couldn't have been cooler. And to have those two guys riffing off each other from two different worlds. Well, they're both British, but two different worlds. And to have it be so good, and Roy was the consummate interviewer. As far as I'm concerned, he's the best interviewer that's ever lived. Roy Leonard, best interviewer that has ever lived. And the fact that he could handle an idiot like me, Clive Barker and John Cleese, and make it work, and he would do it effortlessly. To watch Roy Leonard do a radio show was amazing. It was amazing, and I was privileged to, you know, be a part of his show for many years and to witness him doing a radio show. Not only to witness him doing, you know, interviews, to watch him conduct brilliant, thoughtful, smart interviews, but to see him run the show, like tell the engineer when he needed commercials, talk to the producer, read live reads. And Roy was so amazing at live reads. And anybody who's a regular listener to this radio station for many years knows this. And people who work here know this. People who ever know Roy. You didn't know he was reading a commercial till 30 seconds into the commercial. And you're like, you know what? This dude's reading a commercial. Because he did it so well. He would segue so well into it and read it so in such a conversational way that you'd be like, you know, I would buy anything from this guy. He could sell me anything. Roy Leonard could sell me anything. I, ice to an Eskimo, that kind of thing. That's how great he was. He was a consummate professional. And that morning was really amazing. Just being, you know, Clive Barker and John Cleese. I got to meet them both. It was ridiculous. But Penn and Teller, they were on, and Penn was on, and I told him, I don't want to give away the ending of the movie because I want you to see it because it's extraordinary. And the ending of the movie, and I described what I because it reminded me of a Looney Tunes cartoon. It reminded me of an old Looney Tunes cartoon, and I described which cartoon it was and what happened in the cartoon. And Penn just kind of looked at me and he goes, "Well, you certainly got it." And I'm like, "Okay, good. Where's Arthur Penn?" So I didn't say that. But yeah, I'm so sad that I'm so glad that I've told you about this that you didn't know it.
No, that
Penn and Teller,
amazing.
Penn and Teller get killed, directed by Arthur
Flippin Penn.
Yeah, special movie, man. I'm telling you. All right, we're gonna take a break here. We got the news coming up right after this.
The best Chicago's.
Yeah. It's too bad it's only a twofer this morning. We don't have time for triple play. That's Prince. Who requested the Prince?
I'll give you one guess.
Ike. All right. If it's 80s, it's Ike. If it's Stallone, it's Ike. That's what we know. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man! Wrapping up this morning. And we've been talking about great and memorable and outrageous late night TV moments. Which ones do you remember? Which ones stayed with you? Which ones were the funniest or the weirdest or the most outrageous? Give us a call or send us a text. We'll read them on the air. We want to hear from you. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. So, there you go. We're getting back into this conversation about late night TV, memorable late night TV stuff. 312-981-7200, talk or text. Jason Seahorn. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Say again.
Jason Seahorn. Seahorn. He was a cornerback for the New York Giants.
Yeah, I'm going to say yes. I don't recognize him.
Anyway, he surprised actress Angie Harmon during her Tonight Show interview with her father in tow and said, "Will you marry me?" I know who Angie Harmon is. She was on one of the 19,000 Law and Order shows. She was on the original. Angie Harmon was on the original, and she's got Angie Harmon. She's got a very deep, like, awesome voice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know who also has like a sort of a deep, crazy voice? My future ex-wife, Dana DeLorenzo.
Yeah, she does.
She's got a fantastic voice. Very sexy voice.
Yeah, sultry.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you know that she did an Amy Winehouse tribute show here in Chicago for a couple of years?
You know what? The first time I watched Ash vs. Evil Dead, which is the first time I ever saw her, that was one of the things that ran through my head. I was like, she looks exactly like Amy Winehouse.
And she can sing.
I believe it. With a voice like that?
She can totally sing.
Mm.
She's my future ex-wife, man. I love her. How about this? John Oliver buys a train. He buys a lot of stuff, John Oliver.
They have a big budget. I'd say over at HBO, it's all that Game of Thrones money.
Did you order? And he's not afraid to make fun of Game of Thrones and HBO, which is hilarious.
Especially this past week, when
unbelievably
he says,
funny.
The three greatest lead-ins in the history of television, and we're wasting it on this.
Yeah. But the death penalty thing he did was brilliant.
It was spectacular.
It was like he's just great. I liked when he did the response to the Mike Pence children's book with the bunny, and then he made Marlon Brando or Bando the gay bunny.
Yeah.
I bought two copies of the book.
There you go.
Anyway, John Oliver buys a train. Having an HBO backed budget sure makes for some funny bits. During an episode of Last Week Tonight, John Oliver poked fun at a model train on the set of Scranton, Pennsylvania's ABC affiliate. Apparently, some viewers of the affiliate were offended, so Oliver and his producers dished out for an irresponsibly large train set and donated it to the scrawny news station. He just does brilliant stuff, man. Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford give a masterclass in press junkets. Yes, this morning is technically not a late night show, but trust us, this is one of the best things that you'll see. Like I said, we've said this before, that press tour that Gosling and Harrison Ford did for 2049 was brilliant. It just
it's weird to see Harrison Ford genuinely like another human being.
Yeah.
Especially because, as he said, he hates press junkets.
He hates press junkets, and he's grumpy all the time. And like I've said before, the only movie that he seemed, you know, like happy to be a part of in the past bunch of years was the damn Cowboys versus Aliens movie, which was a terrible movie. But he was the best part of the whole movie.
Yeah,
he seemed to be having a good time. Have you read about Indiana Jones 5?
You know what? After the third and final Indiana Jones, I felt like, you know, why I can't see why they skipped a number.
Oh, no. Oh, are you saying that the fourth one doesn't exist?
Which one?
The fourth one?
Yeah. No, that I don't know.
You just don't acknowledge it?
No.
Oh, okay.
I more or less refuse.
Okay. All right, I understand.
I
remember when my friends and I went to go see that. We saw it at the Davis. We went to Ricochet's beforehand and had some cocktails.
Thank God.
And there were, little did we know. And there were about seven of us. And I like Indiana Jones movies. I don't like the third one. I do not like the Sean Connery one.
Yeah.
I think Last Crusade's not good.
That's a fine one to be split on. That's probably one of the more controversial outside of Crystal Skull.
Yeah. I think Temple of Doom is the best one of the three.
It's awesome.
I love it. I like it better than Raiders.
We're not sinking.
It's I love Temple of Doom.
It's awesome.
It's great. But anyway, so the fifth Indiana Jones, but anyway, when we went to go see the fourth Indiana Jones, the Crystal Skull thing, there were some some of my friends are real hardcore Indiana Jones fans, and you know that there are huge fans of these movies. One person went with me. His all time favorite movie ever is Raiders, and he's seen it like 9,000 times. So we're all basically excited. I was the thing that I was most excited about was Karen Allen was back, and you know, Allison Duty was in the third one. Kate Capshaw was so annoying in the second one, even though I love the movie, you know. But Karen Allen, man, in the first one,
she's about as perfect as a human being can get.
No, I love her. I love Karen Allen. And so I was very excited that Karen Allen was in it. That was like the thing that I was most excited about. But man, was that movie terrible. Oh, my God. About a half an hour into it, we all just started looking at each other going, what the hell is this? By the time LaBeouf is swinging around with monkeys, I was like, what am I? And then aliens show up? Like, what? And then the refrigerator, of course, the famous refrigerator scene.
Right.
You know, a nuclear bomb goes off. He hides in a fridge. Fridge goes flying. He gets out of the fridge. He's fine.
Yeah. The thing is about that fourth movie is that I get what they were shooting for. I absolutely get it. They wanted to do 50s pulp sci-fi.
Right.
That was not how you do that.
No, it was terrible. I mean, really, really terrible. Cate Blanchett was even bad in it. That's how bad that movie was. Cate Blanchett, who I pretty much think she's incapable of being bad. Do you know what movie I loved her in? I mean, I love her in every movie, but what I really loved her in?
Carol?
But Ragnarok.
Yeah, she hammed it up. It was awesome.
I loved her, and I thought she was unbelievably sexy in that movie.
it was one of those roles where you want them to chew scenery, and she just does it. She takes big old bites, and it's very fun.
Yeah. John Stewart basically eviscerates Jim Cramer. These days, you'll see countless headlines proclaiming that some late-night show destroyed or eviscerated a topic or an interview subject. Most of those claims are hyperbolic, but saying Jon Stewart's interview with Mad Money host Jim Cramer deserves a similar term is not. I didn't see that.
It's really good.
Is it? I'm not sure it's online.
Mm-hmm. So. It's very, very good. I would put it up there with John Stewart on Crossfire.
Oh, now I saw that.
He spanks Tucker Carlson like a little boy.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
Yeah. Harrison Ford gets into it with Chewbacca.
Yeah.
In 2013, eternal grouch Harrison Ford went on The Tonight Show, only to end up in an argument with his trusty and fictional sidekick, Chewbacca. I did not see that. 2013, Leno was still the host, right?
Mm-hmm.
In 2013?
Oh, God.
Because it went Leno, Conan, who got screwed by Leno, and then Leno again, and then Fallon. Because I know that changes came right around that time, because 2014 is when Craig left, and then that was when Dave announced that he was leaving, and I think it was the beginning of the season of 2015 is when Colbert took over, so wasn't that around the same time that I'm trying to remember when Fallon took over on The Tonight Show, but I did not see this. What in 2013? What was Harrison Ford? He was probably promoting the Cowboys versus that sounds about the time when the Cowboys versus the Indians came out.
Aliens,
Indians, Cowboys versus Indians. I've never seen that before. That's a new thing.
Was John Wayne in it?
Yeah. Remember the old days? All right. Let's take a quick break here, and we've got some weather, and then after the weather, we will wrap it up. I got a few more memorable and outrageous moments from late-night TV, and we want to hear from you. Text us, 312-981-7200, or call us at the same number. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows at 5 with the opening bell. And coming up is Steve Cochran with your morning drive. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. That was our final Triple Play Thursday, and that was Prince. And we've been talking about late-night TV show moments. And let's see. How about this one? Conan O'Brien gives Jennifer Garner a grammar lesson. Oh, I remember this. I totally remember this. During an interview with Conan O'Brien, Jennifer Garner told the host that snuck is not a word. You went to Harvard. You should know that. And then O'Brien retorted by whipping out a dictionary and proving that the actress was wrong. I totally remember that. She was being so condescending. Bill Murray dressed up as Liberace. For Letterman's 20th anniversary episode, frequent guest Bill Murray showed up on stage as Liberace. In other appearances, Murray also popped out of a cake, showed up in 1700s garb, and to celebrate New York Giants' victory, he came out in full football gear. That's one of those. He's one of those guests on Letterman specifically that killed every single time. Bill Murray, and he did come out dressed in weird things, and his entrances were always crazy. But Letterman and Bill Murray, but Bill Murray was the first guest on his late night show.
Really?
Yeah, Bill Murray was the first guest on Letterman's late night show. Now, are you familiar with the fact that Letterman started out with a morning show?
Yeah, no, I've seen it.
we used to watch it it was on the summer of 1980, and I watched it every single morning. It was on at 9 o'clock in the morning. And he had Edwin Newman from the NBC News sit in the corner and do news breaks. And I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I watched it. I was 15, and I watched it every single morning in the summer of 1980, and it got canceled. And he would do variations on the weird stuff that he would ultimately do in late night, and it did not work at 9 o'clock in the morning, because your audience are the unemployed, the people who work nights, and at that time, like housewives and stuff, who are used to watching morning shows that were just like regular news morning shows, and also soap operas and game shows. That's what dominated weekday mornings. So to have Letterman come on and do this weird stuff, it just was the wrong audience. And luckily, NBC liked him enough to give him a shot at late night, and obviously that's where he fit in more. One of his regular cast guests was Edie McClurg. You know Edie McClurg?
No, where was she from?
She's the principal secretary in Ferris Bueller.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
She's at the Hertz rent-a-car in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah, yeah.
She's in two Cheech and Chong movies. She used to do sketch comedy, stand-up comedy. She's unbelievably funny, unbelievably funny. And she was a regular on Letterman's morning show, and she would do different characters. And I adored his morning show and used to watch it. And then when he got the late night show, I watched that as well. But yeah, it was very weird to see him. You know who else was a great guest on Letterman? Bruce Willis. Because he would come out dressed up like a weirdo or dressed up in some weird way. So Bill Murray dressing up as Liberace. How about the moment that Marlon Brando kissed Larry King? Marlon Brando, not too nuts. And then we've got the famous Joaquin Phoenix, David Letterman moment. Throughout the course of an interview with Letterman to promote his film Two Lovers, Joaquin Phoenix forgets the name of his Two Lovers co-stars and states that he wants to switch careers and become a rapper. As it turned out, the interview was just an instance of Phoenix staying in character, what they used to set up footage for the 2010 mockumentary I'm Still Here, which, again, one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life. John Stewart calls President Obama dude. This may be the first recorded instance of a late show host calling the President of the United States dude. Conan O'Brien lights $1.5 million on fire. Not literally, of course. But when NBC decided to give Conan O'Brien his notice, the host fired back by bringing Bugatti Veyron, the most expensive car at the time, on air and playing the Rolling Stone Satisfaction, the most expensive song to license at the time, in the background.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I mean, he deserves it. He deserves to get to do
that. Well, it's just what NBC and Leno did to him is so unbelievably unfair. Just so ridiculous. And you know what, man? I don't know if you remember, but they did an anniversary special about The Tonight Show, the history of The Tonight Show. And not once in not one clip, and they didn't even mention Conan O'Brien's tenure as host of The Tonight Show. They skipped right over it. And I thought that was a bunch of crap. I really did. And, you know, Lorne Michaels produced the special because Lorne Michaels produced The Tonight Show now. And to leave Conan O'Brien out after the history that he's had with Conan O'Brien, it's pretty unforgivable after what they did.
Well, you know, this is what I'll say about Lorne Michaels. He's a very, I don't know if scrupulous is the word, but like he's a genius in many ways, but there's just so many stories of him being very poisonous and
No. I fully acknowledge that. Here's another thing that really made me mad. Lorne Michaels was interviewed years ago for Playboy, and Playboy historically has very, very, very thorough and long interviews. So he does the interview, mentions everything, does not mention, not one mention of Kids in the Hall in the interview. Not one, and he rarely talks about it. Kids in the Hall, one of the greatest sketch comedies that ever existed. And Lorne Michaels, you know, found those guys and produced that show and never talks about it. So, and then finally, John Oliver brings the Wax Presidents back. So
that's the other one.
To bring it full circle. All right, let's take a break. Hey, our buddy Jeff Goldblum. Jeff Goldblum's going to be on the show tomorrow.
Oh, man.
That would be a get right there. Jeff Tuckman's going to be with us tomorrow.